Good morning and welcome to the September 6, 2022 meeting of the Chelan County Public Utility District Commission. I'd like to thank everyone for participating and remind you to silence your electronic devices that you have with you today. Check mine. For those attending electronically, please mute your screens. Today's meeting is a study and business session with the study session beginning this morning at 10 a.m. and the afternoon session scheduled to begin at 1 p.m. We welcome the public's input at our meetings and remind you that these meetings are being recorded. Excuse me. Members of the public are encouraged to ask specific questions after each item presented. If you wish to provide additional comment or ask questions related to matters not on the agenda, time will be provided in the business session of our meeting this afternoon. If you wish to address any item on the agenda, please raise your hand either physically or electronically, signaling to us that you wish to speak. And if I don't see you, just keep waving on your screen, please. Somebody will let me know that you're trying to be recognized. When we do recognize you, please state your name and address for the record and limit your comments to 3 minutes. Today we have four commissioners present. Ann Congdon will be with us later on this morning. We have Manager Kirk Hudson, General Counsel Eric Wahlquist, and Clerk of the Board Rebecca Newman with us. So this morning, would you please join Cassie Bertelson in leading the Pledge of Allegiance and Safety Minute.
I pledge
allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Morning, Cassie.
Good morning. Do I have control, Rebecca, if I need to do slides? Okay, perfect. So thank you. As mentioned, I'm Cassie Bertelson, Program Manager for Human Performance Efforts here at the district. And I'm pleased to be here this morning to give an HPI Minute at the Board of Commissioners meeting. So for those that might not be aware of what human performance is, I like to describe it as embracing the scientific fact that as humans, we all make errors. Therefore, as an organization, we must create a culture where we can continually learn from our mistakes and build layers of defenses into our systems. That way, when those mistakes happen, not if, we've built the capacity to fail safer. So I'm actually going to build off a previous HPI minute that I presented at the board meeting about a year ago, where I talked about psychological safety. I'll briefly recap on that in a moment. And then another HPI minute that I presented at a general manager's forum a bit earlier this year, where I challenged leaders and employees and will similarly challenge each of you today to think again. So Amy Edmondson defines psychological safety as the belief that the work environment is safe for interpersonal risk taking. But we can also describe it as creating a safe space for people to interact where they won't be punished or humiliated for sharing concerns, ideas, questions, or even for making mistakes. It's about building a work environment where we can take risks and constructively question and contradict one another through intellectual disagreements. Because in a world that is changing more rapidly than ever before, we need to embrace that there will always be more to discover and to understand. Therefore, we need to keep that culture of psychological safety in mind as we force ourselves and challenge each other to think again. As Adam Grant writes, if knowledge is power, then knowing what we don't know is wisdom. And for me, as with many of you, there's definitely a lot that I don't know. With that said, it's easier for us as humans to learn and think more open-mindedly about topics where we are aware of our knowledge gaps. But when we already know or think we know the answers, then the act of rethinking, unlearning, and relearning is much more difficult. And it requires us to put courage over comfort. However, the alternative of being wrong or choosing not to think again can cost time, money, relationships, or even lives. To quote George Bernard Shaw, progress is impossible without change, and those who cannot change their minds cannot change anything. So how can we embrace psychological safety and be sure to challenge ourselves to think again? Be cognizant that rethinking is both a skill and a mindset. And in order to get into that rethinking mode, we need to develop a habit of forming our own second opinions. Additionally, when disagreements arise, we should pause to ensure we don't view them as threats, but instead as opportunities to learn. Next, we need to stop and think, and then we need to make sure that we stop and rethink again often. We all have blind spots in our knowledge and opinions, which in turn leaves us blind to our blindness and gives us false sense of confidence in our judgment and prevents us from rethinking. Lastly, we should prize mental flexibility and embrace that it's okay to be wrong and okay to change our knowledge and our opinions. Because once we find and fix the things we are wrong about, we get one step closer to being right and can start the rethinking process all over again. So my ask of each of you today is to continually think again like a scientist, which involves more than just reacting with an open mind. It means being actively open-minded. Challenge your own thought processes and be constantly aware of the limits of your understanding. Scientific thinking favors humility over pride, doubt over certainty, and curiosity over closure. It requires searching for reasons why we might be wrong, not for reasons why we must be right, and revising our views based on what we learn. If we can support each other in rethinking on a regular basis, we can help the district move towards becoming a true learning organization, which resiliently adapts our systems to better protect our people and our assets from inevitable errors. So thanks for listening, and be sure to challenge each other to keep thinking again.
So, another book to read.
Homework, right?
Great. Well, Cassie, the book that you mentioned as you started, Amy Edmondson, has been one of the best books and that I've organizational improvement books that I've read in a long time. I keep going back and referring to that. So I'm looking forward to reading this Think book by Adam Grant, and I'm challenged with that, and I appreciate your comments today. So
absolutely
look forward to another book.
It's been one of my favorites.
So, Cassie, a great safety moment, and I was reminded as you gave that back in another life about 30 years ago, I was involved in pear research as a grower, funding of research projects. And one of the icons in our industry used to say, he said, you know, the research is great, he said, but the unexpected results are sometimes even greater. What we don't know that we're not even looking for that we discover in that process. And I was really reminded about that, you know, keep an open mind about learning new things, even if you don't expect them. Yeah. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks, Cassie.
Thanks, Cassie.
Commissioners, staff has recommended moving resolutions 10 and 11 to the consent agenda for your consideration. Additionally, for the public's information, items on the consent agenda are subject to transfer to the regular agenda upon any request of any commissioner. Do I hear any such request or additions, changes to the agenda?
Mr. President, I believe that agenda items 10 and 11 have been requested to move to consent.
That's great by me.
All right. So with nothing else, I see a head nod from Dennis. The agenda stands, including item resolutions 10 and 11 to the consent agenda. Okay, Kirk, I'm going to turn this over to you to introduce agenda item number 3.
Great, thank you. Agenda item number 3 is a Power Risk Management Committee update, and with us is Jamie Mitchell. Welcome, Jamie.
Good morning, Jamie Mitchell. I work in the district's Enterprise Risk Management Group, and I work in what we call the district's middle office. So that is the oversight function for energy planning and trading. So I actually sit down with their group and work with them regularly. So today I'm here to talk about Power Risk Management Committee resolution updates. So as you know, the district's operating environment has changed quite a bit over the last 10 plus years. The last time we had a Power Risk Management Committee resolution update was in 2011, so it's been some time. There have been some changes related to retail load growth and the increase in requests related to retail load growth. And the district's portfolio mix has also been updated, as I know you're aware, through the recent board presentations. So I'd like to introduce a new proposed resolution today that updates both the membership of the committee and then also the charter to be included. The charter is something that when the first original resolution was adopted in 1998, the charter has remained the same ever since. So it's time to evolve and bring that up to date. So a little bit of history around the Power Risk Management Committee. And I think just for time, I'll refer to it as PRMC, if that's okay, from this point forward. So again, it was originally formed by resolution in 1998 with six voting members. There have been various versions of the committee over the years. So there's been five resolutions of updates since then. The purpose of the committee was to establish additional procedures, guidelines, and safeguards regarding energy and capacity sales and purchases. In 2004, that resolution introduced the concept of the GM having ultimate authority on all committee decisions. So the committee members are the voting members, and then the general manager has ultimate veto authority. So some of the way that our operating environment has changed. So the way that we have transacted has changed since the last PRMC resolution. Again, the significant load growth potential, that has resulted in a need for a new perspective and a more holistic view. And that's why we are proposing today to update the membership. And then finally, the long-term marketing strategy and portfolio mix also supports the evolution of the PRMC with the charter and also the update in membership. So for the membership, the 2011 resolution includes the following voting members: the CFO and CRO, the General Counsel, the Managing Director of Energy Resources, the Managing Director of Generation and Transmission, and the Managing Director of District Services. We are proposing that all the members remain the same, with the exception of swapping out the Managing Director of District Services with the Managing Director of Customer Utilities, and that is to give us the focus on the retail load side of things and making sure we're looking at things holistically. And then as far as the charter, again, it's been the same since 1998, so as you can imagine, there's a lot that's different since then. The original charter was more focused on credit and contract-related items, and we would like to propose that it is updated to kind of evolve and show what the PRMC is more focused on today, which is a lot more than just credit and contract-related items. It's more so approving hedging strategies, portfolio mix, trading and position limits. Of course, credit is still included and it's still a focus, but there's so much more that the PRMC is doing, and so we want to make sure that's all-encompassing as we move forward with the new resolution. So our next steps are to present the updated resolution at the next board meeting on September 19th for approval. And I can answer any questions about those two updates at this time, if you have any.
Randy?
Yeah. Something that emerged in my mind, you made a decision to recommend a change on the committee from one managing director to another. Was there the thought process that went into making a switch rather than just making an addition to the committee? Is the rationale?
Sure. Let me go back to that slide. So as you can see, there are five members of the committee. Mm-hmm. That makes it really nice for voting purposes when we're voting on items to not have an even number. So rather than adding a new committee member that would have put us at six committee members, it was best to stay at five. So then you have the ability to have a vote that's not tied.
But ultimately, the general manager makes all final decisions.
He does, if he does not agree with the vote of the committee.
And so that was the rationale.
Yeah, I can add to that, too. That, you know, we look at the purpose of every voting member, and there was an emphasis back 2011 timeframe and earlier, more on the communication side. Then since then, we've put a whole stakeholder outreach process in place, and we've got a whole another process that informs the communication. So looking at every voting member and the purpose of them on the committee, we look back and said, okay, we've got other things in place on the communication side. Okay. And the load growth in the county was such that it does weigh into a lot of our decisions more so now than we've had in the past. And so we just felt like it made sense to just swap the two out.
Okay.
Or swap the two.
Yeah.
Gary?
I had a question. Can you go forward one slide? We're talking in, so the updated charter doesn't specifically state that you're going to continue to focus on credit and contract related items, but in addition to these other items. Is that how I should interpret it? Not instead of credit and contract focus.
We still review the credit and contract focus.
At the same level of emphasis.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Definitely still important.
Yeah.
Dennis?
Jamie, excuse me. I'm going to ask a kind of a historical perspective and then ask a question related to that. The inception of this in 1998 predated Enron. Shortly following that, our own PUD became involved and a particularly as reported in our board retreat at Port Ludlow that considered a second marketing agency known as a non-public entity. It was kind of that event that led to the awareness in the community that there were things that the PUD that needed to be addressed. This charter in the aforementioned committee existed at the time. Does the update in the charter, the change in the structure of who's on it, does that ensure that ratepayers of Chelan County that we are highly unlikely to ever return to that type of model or thinking? And that would be my caution.
I think maybe I'll take that one, Commissioner Bolts. I think a lot has changed since 1998, and I would say there's a lot more transparency into what's happening at the Power Risk Management Committee meetings and with minutes and regular meetings and notes accordingly. And I would say that in addition, the board would be involved in anything along those lines that you're referring to that has happened in the past, something of that level, and complete transparency there too. So I think there's other safeguards in place for that, and I think what you see here is updating because the world has changed a lot in the energy resources side of the business as well as our enterprise risk management approaches. So our policies are changing accordingly, updating them to reflect that.
I think, you know, part of my caution or where I'm coming from is at the time of Enron and through that period of time, the power marketing industry was very fluid. And it's not the same fluidness now, but the pace of change is so significant. I guess what I'm asking is, does this document, does this structure allow us to have the nimbleness to respond to the market and ensure, again, the ratepayer that we're operating in their best interest, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I think that actually clarification helps a lot. And I think one of the things, the way I like to think about this, Commissioner Bolts, is that, you know, we've been very public about our wholesale marketing strategy. And so we've been, and what I see is this policy actually helps us to operate within those that strategy and provides limits to do so. And so that's the way I see it is, you know, we're very public about our marketing strategy, and the policy helps us keep in line with what we said we were going to do, if that helps.
Yeah. Well, it does. I think there's also another factor in there. Into some of our decision-making, we've incorporated, I think, a lot more community input. People like Bart Clinton, and I see Malachi in the background today. People who are willing to step up and ask intelligent questions about what it is we're doing and how we're doing. And the response, whether it's agreed upon or not, has been thoughtful. And I think that's an indication, and it's kind of like our HBI moment this morning, you know, thinking and rethinking. So there's a congruency here that I'm really liking. But I guess I just, I think the vigilance of what is chartered here and the leadership, how it's structured here, is a continual valued piece and needs to be encouraged and, you know, made public. So, and if I talk long enough, I'll finally get around to what it is I want to say. But so I'll stop there and hope that it's sufficient. But those are my concerns. I appreciate the answers. And thanks for taking the time to Jamie and the rest of the people involved for taking a look at the structure and remodeling that and bringing it forward and moving it into a really fast-moving market. I mean, I just look at, you know, California almost daily. How do you keep pace with that? And what we need to. So anyway, thanks to everyone.
Thanks, Dennis. Commissioners, any other questions?
Steve, I just want to further, I guess, further have a clarification in that. I want to make sure I understand. And Dennis, thank you for expanding your question and your thought process that as I look at the changes requested in the charter, I'm not necessarily interpreting, and please correct me if I'm wrong, expanded authorities. I'm interpreting that we're going to continue to focus on credit and contract related items, but in addition, we're going to look at procedures to limit risk exposure. And then we just specifically state those areas that we're going to consider. Am I interpreting that incorrectly?
No, you're interpreting it correct. In fact, I would say this reflects how we're operating more than anything
right
now. And yeah, it's just how we've evolved over the years. And what Jamie's bringing forward is a more accurate reflection of those other things that we are taking into consideration now.
Good. So
you're interpreting it correctly.
Good. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Dennis.
Commissioner Arsenault, I would want to concur with your conclusion. Support that.
Thank you.
Anything else, commissioners?
Thank you, Jamie.
All right. Thank you, Jamie.
Thanks, Jamie.
All right. We're into the quarterly fish and wildlife update. Elaine and Catherine.
Good morning, Commissioner.
Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I'm Aline Underwood, Fish and Wildlife Manager. With me today is Catherine Willard, our Senior Fisheries Biologist. And it's been, I think, more than a quarter since we've come to present. So we have a lot to talk about today, but we'll try and keep it concise. So we're actually going to focus just on fisheries today because there's so much to talk about. So I want to give a quick update on our Habitat Conservation Plan hatchery recalculation update. This happens every 10 years. It's a significant level of effort for our staff that I thought would be good to report on. I want to talk very briefly about ocean conditions. We've talked to the board about that in the past. And also to give an update on our the Columbia River sockeye returns this year, which were really quite phenomenal. So with that, I'll turn it over to Catherine.
All right. Good morning. Yes, I'm going to first talk about hatchery recalc. And so the habitat conservation plans, also referred to as the HCP, were signed in 2004, if you remember. And they were for Rock Island and Rocky Reach to reach mitigation for operation of those hydro facilities. And so the idea of the HCP was to achieve no net impact for planned species. And planned species are coho, sockeye, chinook, salmon, and steelhead. And so there's a three-pronged approach to achieving no net impact through the HCPs. And this includes, one, maintaining a level of survival for a 91% combined juvenile and adult survival for species that pass both of our projects. And we measure that with the check-ins every 10 years. And then second is we contribute funds to the planned species account, and those funds are used to fund habitat improvement projects in the tributaries. And third is the 7% hatchery compensation. And with the signing of the HCP, the hatchery committee was also designated, and it consists of a signatory to the HCP. So U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, NOAA Fisheries, WDF&W, Yakima Nation, Colville Tribes, and then, of course, ourselves. And I'm the representative on the hatchery committee for the district. And so when the HCP was signed, it designated the hatchery committee, and the hatchery committee oversees implementation of our hatchery programs. And in addition, we also recalc the level, or recalculate, we refer to it as recalc all the time, we recalculate the level of hatchery mitigation every 10 years. So that's what I'm going to talk to you about today. And when the HCP was being negotiated, a level of initial production is what we call it, was set for hatchery production, and it was around 2.5 million smolts, which is a lot compared to what we produce now. And the idea was to have this initial production to get through the HCP negotiations, and then we would recalculate the production in 10 years. And so now we have hatchery production consists of two components. There's inundation production, which never changes. So this production is mitigation in the main stem Columbia, for where our projects have inundated spawning habitat for summer chinook and steelhead. So that number never changes. But what is recalculated is no net impact, or NNI production, and that's what I'm going to talk about today. And so that's what we recalculate every 10 years. So what is recalculation, and how does the hatchery committee do this? So we mitigate for hatchery origin fish and natural origin fish for plants, all planned species. So we utilize measure juvenile survival values at the projects, and we utilize data that's derived from our hatchery monitoring evaluation program. And as you recall, we come to the board every year to request funding for our hatchery and monitoring evaluation programs for to meet our objectives for our plan. And got a lot to talk about here. So mitigating for the hatchery origin component is relatively straightforward. We don't negotiate that at all during recalc. So for example, it's mitigating for federal facility production. And so a specific example is Leavenworth National Fish Hatchery. They release about 1.2 million spring chinook smolts every year. And so to calculate the production that we owe for Leavenworth spring chinook smolts is we take our unavoidable project mortality that we measure, which is 6.07%, and multiply that by their releases. So we owe about 75,000 spring chinook smolts for mitigation for Rock Island Dam. So that's super straightforward, not hard to negotiate. What becomes tricky is figuring out how to mitigate for natural origin production, which natural origin, we mean fish that are produced in the wild. And so there's multiple ways to do this, and we collect data that does measure. There's different ways to come up with mitigation for natural origin production. And so that's what we end up negotiating with the Hatchery Committee. And we use the data that we collect to monitor our hatchery programs to also do this hatchery recalc. The first hatchery recalc, which was completed in 2011, took about 15 months. This last hatchery recalc that we completed 2 months ago took about 16 months. And so what that consists of is we meet monthly, and we have all-day meetings, and we discuss and negotiate what will be used to do recalc. And then we also meet in between those meetings. And then we also meet one-on-one. I think the most effective way to get through recalc was I would set up one-on-one meetings to negotiate how we're going to get to the endpoint. And all this was done during COVID. So you can imagine it was pretty challenging. It would have been easier, I think, meeting face-to-face, but we got through it through many, many Teams meetings. So it was quite challenging. So this table here shows what the smolt production targets were for that initial period, 2004 through 2013. And as you can see, and I mentioned earlier, it's the level is quite high compared to the first recalc was completed in 2011. And this middle column here shows what the production values were for release year 2014 through 2023. And then 2024 is release year 2015 through 2024 through 2033. And so let's just take a look at summer Chinook for Chelan Falls. And as I mentioned, we have inundation production, and that never changes. So it's always 400,000. Never changes. And same for Steelhead, we have inundation mitigation, which is 165,000, never changes. So what we did recalculate for Chelan Falls is the NNI, which the last recalc it was 176,000, and this time it's 135,000-ish. And so the reason it changes is because we have different smolt to adult survival rates, we have different survival for smolts going out, measured survival that we did with our check-in. And so that can all affect what this NNI calculation is. And the NNI for Chelan Falls is actually mitigation for natural origin smolts produced in the Metau, if that makes sense.
Would it be fair to say that that lower number you're seeing on several of those reflects success in the past?
Yes, yeah, I would say that.
Yeah, very clearly shows.
Yes. Great point. So these are our traditional programs and how we achieve mitigation through recalc. Then we have some exceptions to those traditional programs. For example, Chief Joe, we mitigate for Chief Joe hatchery production. And the district owns and operates the Milkamine acclimation facility. And we meet part of our mitigation through operating that. And Chief Joe Hatchery over winter acclimates their summer Chinook, part of their summer Chinook production there. And then additionally, we have a funding agreement to fund part of their M&E program. Other exceptions are the Okanagan sockeye and the coho reintroduction programs. We also have sharing agreements with the Yakima Nation for the coho reintroduction program. And then, as you recall, we have the hatchery up in Penticton, which we fund with conjunction with Grant PUD. And that is how we meet our mitigation for Okanagan sockeye. And then Lake Wenatchee sockeye is unique in the sense that during the last recalculation, the hatchery committee decided to convert the calculated Lake Wenatchee smolt production, convert it to a different species that was more productive. And I'll talk about that here in a little bit in more detail. But instead of producing, for example, in 2014, 46,000 sockeye smolts, we converted that to steelhead, if that makes sense.
So really briefly, wanted to give you an update on ocean conditions. So we just talked about our hatchery calculation that occurs in our sort of stretch of the river. Recall last year we presented some of the findings from a couple of papers, Drs. Burke and Welch, and they wrote some papers about the effects of the overall survival of salmon and steelhead with relation to ocean conditions. And one interesting finding, Burke concluded that even if the freshwater survival in the river was 100%, because of the warming ocean conditions, salmon and steelhead populations, he posited, will not recover. And then he then went on to encourage fisheries managers to include impacts of the ocean on decisions about their management of the freshwater component. So that was just one study. But what's interesting is that all of this comes from monitoring that the that NOAA, which is the it's the National Marine Fisheries Service, does. They've done it since 1996. They monitor ocean conditions from Newport all the way up into Alaska. So they've been collecting all of this data. So what I really wanted to talk about today, or I guess to convey, is that they have been doing this since 1996. And this is really more for illustrative purposes. You know, you can see over here on the left, there's all these different parameters that they monitor. What's interesting is that this year, so this was the results from 2021 studies, all of these are basically stoplight indicators. So your classic red being not good, green or sort of bluey color is good. And 2021 was actually the second best ocean condition trend since they've been doing this for 16 years. So really interesting things to note. And I think that the reason we wanted to share this is, you know, what's really important is that while we do as much as we can to protect the fish that swim through our stretch of the river, whether that's, you know, our mitigation that Catherine just described, our, you know, investments in hydro to increase our survival through our projects, our fish spend about a month in the river. But they spend from 1 to 3 years actually in the ocean. So just good context for us. It'll be interesting to see kind of how these progress over time. But one of the good things that has come out of this is actually what Catherine's going to talk about next.
Yes, which it's a great year for sockeye returns. I'm sure you've all heard.
Catherine, before you go there,
uh-huh. Yeah.
Let me go back to,
sure.
I just found that fascinating that you look at year after year of bad news, and then all of a sudden in 21, wow, what you happened? Know. What are they attributing that to?
So what they're attributing it to is there were actually, I won't go into it, but there's, because it's a lot of complicated scientific stuff that I don't even completely understand, but basically the main food source for the fish, which are copepods, was the highest that they've ever seen since they've been monitoring this. So for whatever reason, the things that were going on in the previous year, there was a cooler spring, which helped the copepod species. That certainly helped tremendously. But it just goes to show that, you know, we were reporting last year on all these red things from 19. You know, that was the blob, right? That warm blob. That things can rebound. I think all of the NOAA scientists would also encourage us to, you know, this is just 1 year.
Just 1 year.
And that it's certainly not getting better over time. Like, yep. This is not an up and to the right sort of graph. This is a really good news story for a year. But it is great for this particular year.
I was fascinatingly interested. I just found that fascinating.
Yeah, I think we all have.
I'll be anxious to see what happens in the next few years.
We all will, yeah.
Thank you. Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, yeah, no worries. Yeah, so every spring we forecast what we think are going to be the adult returns. And so this past spring, the forecast for sockeye was around 200,000 adults. Well, we ended up getting about 640,000 adults back to Bonneville. And the reason probably for the forecast being so far off is probably due to ocean conditions. We use regression analysis to predict what we think the returns are going to be. And a lot of the predictor variables have included years of poor ocean conditions. So it's great news for adult returns, and that's what I'm going to talk about next.
Excuse me, what was the return number, the actual? We had forecasted 200,000, and how many came back?
640.
600.
Yep.
And that's to Bonneville Dam.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is the 10-year and 4-year average of adult returns at Rocky Reach. And so this is just Okanagan sockeye that are headed up to the Okanagan. And as you can see, it was a lot of fish this year. And more specifically, we'll look at annual counts at Rocky Reach. And so this year at Rocky Reach, our fish counters, they counted a lot of fish. I mean, it wasn't just sockeye, but it was over a million fish. And 530,000 sockeye alone, which is a record year since the last 30 years I put on this graph.
I think I'd go blind counting.
For sure. What I did add to this figure here was, as I mentioned, we have a sockeye hatchery up in Penticton, and not that this sockeye hatchery was fully responsible for this increase in adult returns. It definitely contributed because it's a reintroduction program. So, as you mentioned, another success for the district, for sure. And what folks often ask, and I was actually at a fisheries conference a couple weeks ago, feels like years ago, why for Okanagan sockeye, you can see how the one year it's high returns, the next year it's low returns, high returns, low returns. And that one of the hypotheses is that they are so responsive to environmental conditions. So, for example, in 2014, we had a big return, but not very many of the adults were able to spawn because that was a year when we had really warm river conditions. And a lot of them died before they were able to spawn. And you can see that as a reflection in the 2017 return. So we also have rain on snow events that scour out reds that have been already made in the river. And we've had, there was one more thing that I was going to mention on that, but it is definitely due to environmental conditions. And then, hopefully folks were able to partake in the Lake Wenatchee fishery this year. It was also a record year with 110,000 sockeye at Tumwater Dam, which is amazing. We had another good return year in 2014, but again, that was a really warm year. So as I mentioned, we, during the last recalc 10 years ago, we had discontinued. We used to have a hatchery program for Lake Wenatchee sockeye. So rootstock was collected at Tumwater Dam, brought to East Bank, fish were spawned, early reared, and then brought up to net pens at Lake Wenatchee where they were put in there in the spring and released in the fall. And the hatchery committee, after reviewing the M&E data that we collect for the program, evaluated the program and decided that it would be better to discontinue the hatchery program because it wasn't meeting the objectives that were set by the HCP monitoring plan. And I put when the last release was, which was 2012, and as you can see, we still have a increase in adult returns, a trend of increases. And one of the things that we, I wasn't there, but one of the objectives that was used to evaluate the success of the hatchery program was the goal was for it, the program to contribute to harvest, recreational and tribal harvest. And during harvest, only 4% of the hatchery returns, of the harvest consisted of hatchery returns. So that with other metrics that we used to evaluate the program, it was decided to discontinue the program. But again, as you can see, the trend is still increasing returns for Lake Wenatchee sockeye. And so we do still continue to meet our mitigation. We conduct monitoring and evaluation activities for naturally produced sockeye out of Lake Wenatchee. And then additionally, project sponsors can put in for habitat improvement projects in Lake Wenatchee and the tributaries for sockeye, because there's a lot of funding for ESA listed species, ESA listed steelhead and salmon in the valley, but there is not really a funding source for sockeye besides the district's tributary fund. So we mitigate through the tributary fund and then conducting M&E activities for Lake Wenatchee sockeye. And with that, are there any other questions?
Randy.
So it might surprise you that the ocean conditions chart you showed, it's not the first time I've seen it. About 2 weeks ago, we had a presentation at our Rotary meeting in Kashmir by a biologist who lives in Kashmir and works for WDFW, Jeremy Graham.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this was a beautiful reinforcement to what he talked about. He talked specifically about up the Wenatchee River Valley, what's going on. So he talked about Tumwater Dam, and he talked about the challenges with propagation of fish as you get to Lake Wenatchee and above. And as you know, you alluded to it also, but I found it fascinating that the upper end of the Wenatchee River before it reaches Lake Wenatchee appears to be a place where spawning really does take place, and not so much the tributaries. Has the committee, you know, got their arms around any whys? Why is no knowledge as to why this occurs? The Little Wenatchee and the White River don't seem to do well
for
spawning.
Oh yeah, well, so for the Little Wenatchee and White for sockeye spawning, they do fairly well. The problem with that, there are a couple natural barriers on there. I think the Little Wenatchee, and so they're not able to get upstream from there. And then for Spring Chinook, we conduct spawning ground surveys for the White and Little Wenatchee. It's really hard to actually count reds in the White River due to the turbidity of the water. So it's hard to actually measure spawning success in the White River. But I would say that I wouldn't say that it's really spawning limited. I would be interested to hear what Jeremy was referring to, because we do tend to get good production from those.
Well, he did catch my attention, and I've suggested that he and I have coffee because he lives about half a mile from the coffee shop.
Yeah, you should. I'd be interested to hear what he was more specifically referring to.
And then
where, I guess, I would say where spawning is limited is the upper Wenatchee between Tumwater and Lake Wenatchee. And that's the focus area. So the RTT, the Regional Technical Team for the Salmon Recovery Board, which I'm on, we have done a prioritization for where habitat is limited and where we should focus our habitat restoration activities. And it's definitely in that area between Tumwater and Lake Wenatchee. And so perhaps he was referring to that, because that area, there's a lot of development and there's just not a lot of complex habitat that is available for fish to spawn in.
Okay. Well, if I get more education from him, I'll let you know.
Yes, that'd be great.
Okay.
Do you have a question?
Excuse me. Eileen, Dennis, the Lake Wenatchee situation changed in 2012, you said. Is that correct?
Yes.
Was that the fish pens?
Yes.
Okay. There was quite a bit of controversy at that time that the feed from the fish pens were creating a higher algae growth around Lake Wenatchee. Eliminating those pens, did it mitigate that situation, or is it still pretty much the same?
So,
or do we know?
So you're right. There was a perception that the net pens were contributing to some poor water quality. We actually tested that water quality and never actually documented any sort of deleterious effects from the net pens. And we haven't done anything since we removed the net pens. Grant Pudi used them for a while for one of their fish production facilities, and I'm not sure what the water quality there is like now.
Yeah.
We haven't done any testing.
It was just an issue that, no pun intended, kind of evaporated.
Mm-hmm.
But it was certainly, I just remember going to meetings at the recreation hall at Lake Wenatchee and just getting skewered because of the algae. And just haven't had that experience lately, and I'm okay with that. But
yes,
I just wondered if we had any evidence of, and I know at the time we did extensive water testing, and there was no correlation that could be determined, but it's just interesting that that's calmed down.
Thanks, Dennis.
Thank you.
Gary?
Thank you. I just had a question, more from my own knowledge, about the spawning, the length of spawning. So will they continue to spawn through the month of September, or is that pretty much over?
For sockeye?
Yeah.
Yes, they actually they spawn through October. Yeah.
Great.
They're later spawners for sure. Yeah.
And so will you be then continuing to track the numbers to see if they continue to grow?
Yeah, so we actually do a mark recapture. We don't do spawning ground surveys for sockeye anymore up in Lake Wenatchee. We used to a long time ago. But we do, we pit tag a certain number of adults at Tumwater as they're going through the ladder. And then we do a mark recapture estimate. So we basically still estimate how many fish spawn in or escape into the White River in Little Wenatchee. And we have those spawner escapement estimates, yep.
So those great numbers are likely to get bigger.
Yeah.
That you showed us.
For sure. Unfortunately, though, I will say, as you referred to, is that it is spawning limited. And so if you have too many fish per habitat area available, they'll superimpose their reds on top of each other, and then they don't necessarily survive as well as if they had more habitat available.
I see.
Yeah. And so that's why it's really good to have a harvest on Lake Wenatchee sockeye, because the habitat capacity is limited for sure.
Sure.
Yeah.
Fishermen are doing a service to them.
Yes, they are.
They are. Right. You heard it here. So maybe we can get a final count or final estimate in October when you pull your numbers together and kind of compile everything.
Yeah.
That'd be fascinating to learn.
Yeah.
Congratulations, by the way. This is great numbers.
And
great.
When is Salmon Festival?
It's in 2 weeks. I think. 2 weeks. Yeah,
I think so. Yeah.
And we will be there?
Yes.
We are hosting it this year.
Yeah.
Oh, we are.
That's good.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Yeah, we like our fish up the valley.
Great.
Great news.
Okay.
Thank you.
Lane and Catherine, thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Good seeing you. Well, I'm fascinated with that ocean information change.
When I first saw it, I thought maybe somebody shot it with a shotgun. I mean, it was just such a blob of...
Interesting. All right. So we're moving on to item number five, Climate Commitment Act Cost Burden Analysis with Mike Bradshaw.
And Tuli Hakala's on the line, too.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning.
Mike Bradshaw, Director of Energy Structuring and Trading. As Kirk mentioned, we have Tuli Hakala on the line, who's the real expert. So,
Good morning.
Good morning.
So we came and talked back on July 18th about the Climate Commitment Act, the cap and trade for Washington, and this concept of a cost burden and what that means. And so we're back today. We're not asking for any action, but just to go through the forecast that we've put together and to discuss that in this realm of a no-cost concept under the CCA, with the intent of coming back in a couple weeks to ask for adoption of a forecast. So Tuli's going to give a bit of a background on what the Climate Commitment Act is, and we'll go into the forecast.
Thank you, Mike. Okay, let me get started here. So much of what I'll cover is a review, and I think it's in fact, a review of a review. And so I won't spend too much time here. If at any point you have questions, please stop me. So the Climate Commitment Act, as we know, this is Washington's cap and invest program. We're joining California and Quebec in having cap and invest programs. The way the program works, generally speaking, is if you're a business and you're emitting more than 25,000 metric tons of CO2 equivalent in a year, you're subject to the program, your emissions are regulated unless you're exempted. And some of the key exemptions for Washington are agricultural businesses and then certain types of fuels. And what that ends up including when you factor out those exceptions is the electric sector, electric utilities are regulated, natural gas utilities, components of the transportation sector, and then certain the lead state agency under the program, and so they're responsible for setting up the program and running it. And the way they do that is they use Washington's greenhouse gas reduction targets to create annual caps. And an annual cap is essentially it's a number that reflects the amount of emissions that are allowable under the program for a given year in a manner that still allows Washington to meet those greenhouse gas targets over time. And based on each annual cap, the Department of Ecology will allocate a certain amount of allowances. And I like to think of an allowance as a pollution permit. And so if you have an allowance, that essentially is a reflection of regulatory approval to emit 1 ton of CO2 equivalent over the course of a year. And since those allowances are tied to those caps, which decline over time, the number of allowances under the program will decline over time as well. And just based on supply-demand economics, it'll get more and more expensive to get an allowance, meaning it'll get more and more expensive to emit. Under that program, certain businesses are eligible for no-cost allowances, and electric utilities are eligible for no-cost allowances through the end of 2044. And that that date that was selected, end of 2044, that aligns with CETA. And you may recall that CETA requires electric utilities to be
Julie, I'm going to back you up just for a minute. You cut out there. Every time you cut out, I'll stop and have you back up just 30 seconds. We lost you there.
Sure. Okay. So let me start over again with no-cost allowances. So under this program, electric utilities are eligible for no-cost allowances. So rather than having to buy them at auction, utilities are eligible to receive a certain amount of no-cost allowances based on their unique needs. And Mike Bradshaw will get into that and what that might look like for us. But utilities are only eligible for no-cost allowances through the end of 2044. And that date was selected to align with the Clean Energy Transformation Act, CETA, which requires utilities to be 100% clean in terms of their supply by 2045. Next slide, please. So the amount of no-cost allowances that any particular utility will be eligible for is tied to the concept of a cost burden. And if you're a fan of reading statutory language, we excerpted the statutory definition of cost burden on this slide. But the gist of it is essentially you ask, what is the financial burden on a utility, and therefore that utility's customers, of being subject to this program? What is that incremental cost? You calculate that, and then you provide no-cost allowances to mitigate that financial burden. And so for an electric utility, since we're already subject to CETA, to the Clean Energy Transformation Act, the concept here is that so long as you're meeting your obligations under CETA, you should be receiving no-cost allowances in an amount that captures the value, the financial burden, that value of any additional cost that cap and trade imposes on utilities. It's a little difficult to describe, and so I'm going to hand it over to Mike Bradshaw, and he's going to go into the different components of a cost burden, what those look like, and then he's going to jump into how we might calculate a cost burden for our own PUD.
Thank you, Julie.
You're welcome.
To get to the specifics, give me kind of a recap since July, but we haven't bucketed it into three different buckets: the direct, indirect, and administrative. And so we expect to have potentially all three, have costs associated with all three. And just to reiterate, Ecology does intend to allocate these no-cost allowances to offset this cost burden. So the three are the direct, and which may be not apparent because obviously we have all carbon-free energy resources, but because in the rule, Bonneville can elect not to comply with the Cap and Invest program, and if that is the case, basically the carbon obligation rolls to their downstream. So to the amount that we import energy in the wholesale market from Bonneville, from buying and selling, in this case from buying, we can have a carbon obligation associated with that energy. Indirect, that is because carbon will now be priced into the dispatch decisions of utilities when they're making their decisions to fire up a unit or not. The costs of that carbon will be included in the energy price. And so when we are purchasing energy, the cost for the energy will be higher. And then third is administrative, and that is just kind of the staff time to get the program up and running and to track and surrender allowances or assign them to auction. So be. So a continuation of cost burden. We currently have public forecasts of supply and demand through our IRP and our CEIP, but those don't fully capture the direct and indirect costs from the Cap and Invest. So we have been working with other utilities in Washington State to come up with a template. It's a fairly simple spreadsheet that just lists out your supply and your demand in an attempt to show Ecology a consistent way that they could look at every utility's cost burden and the associated allowances that would be required to offset that. And then lastly, the bottom bullet there in bold is ultimately Ecology does have the final say in what each utility will be allocated to cover the cost burden.
Mike, may I ask a question, please?
Sure.
Why does Bonneville, what's the thinking behind Bonneville having the opportunity to be voluntary?
I'll probably kick that to Thule, but Washington State doesn't have the jurisdiction over Bonneville, and so they have opportunity.
That's what I was wondering. Thank you. Thanks.
Okay. So, so what we're recommending for a renewable supply forecast, again, no action needed today. Come back in a couple weeks to adopt a forecast, as we're recommending a renewable supply forecast that's equal to 80% of the energy to serve our load. And we would use that number in the cost burden worksheet. If we do adopt an 80% number, we will reevaluate our targets we currently have in our CEIP, which refers to a 90%. And we may make updates on the next normal cycle when we do the IRP and the CEIP updates. And so down below is just a snippet of what that looks like in that spreadsheet. Two lines, the top one would be essentially 80% of that bottom line. The bottom line is a forecast of our load, and the top line would be the amount of renewable and non-emitting resources, essentially our hydro and our small percentage of wind. So those reflect how we intend to serve 80% of load with with renewable energy.
Is that an ecology spreadsheet, or is that our developed spreadsheet?
Yeah, it started with California. That's what they had used, something very similar. So we started with what they had used and modified it for our program up here in Washington. Hmm. Ecology didn't have much. They had, I think, a formula that was pretty small and didn't really capture what the true cost burden would be for each utility. So it was an attempt that California started it. We worked through the PGP group as a team to modify it and have it reflect what we think would be right for the Washington program. It has been shared with them. I haven't heard, and Julie, you may have, I've not heard of any feedback yet from ecology, but it was shared with them that here's what utilities proposed or are proposed to submit. Some of the support for selecting an 80% energy to serve load target or a renewable supply forecast really boils down to flexibility and opportunity. Having a lower percentage, it provides flexibility to respond to water and load uncertainty. We know every year is different, load and particularly water. It also provides flexibility to respond to extreme load growth. We have customers looking to connect to the system that perhaps may not choose to have 100% carbon-free. It's hard to purchase carbon-free in the market. This provides some flexibility to serve those loads at less than 100%. And then on the opportunity side, it does allow for additional carbon-free sales, which aligns with our customer interest of keeping our retail rates low, which was, again, supported in the, I think it was the May customer satisfaction survey that went out. That was a top response of why you positively view Chelan UD was good rates. And then it also aligns with the 2030 CETA target. And just to be clear, there is no requirement for a target under the CCA. But under CETA, there is you must serve 80% of your load with renewable energy by 2030. So it aligns with that target 8 years early. And then tying it back to our mission and vision, highlight in red some of the items that would be impacted. I think it's probably obvious that we do live in a rapidly changing utility environment in every form right now, it seems like, with markets, and with resource adequacy, and with environmental carbon, CETA. A lot is changing, and it does provides the best for the most for the longest. Again, pointing back to incremental revenue from additional carbon-free sales, which that revenue can be used to help provide sustainable reliable utility services. And then lastly, looking back at our values. It aligns the work with customer owner interests. Looking at long-term, not just short-term, this is something to do through 2045 that could have an impact. So it's looking long-term and being transparent with what renewable target we would be selecting. And then it also is in accordance with applicable laws, policies, and regulations. So next steps is, again, this is we plan to come back in the 19th to adopt a forecast. After that is adopted, we will submit that to the Department of Ecology in our template spreadsheet. They are planning to have some rulemaking complete by October 1st. So we're kind of down to the last bit of time here. But by having something submitted to them ahead of October 1st is the intent. So they can take that look at it. And, best case would be this looks good. We'll accept it. But then, again, based on their response, we may have to revise or pursue a different approach. So ultimately, they have the say, and we just don't know what that will look like when it's all said and done. And with that, are there any questions?
Commissioners, any questions? Any public comment on that? Any questions? All right. Well, Mike, thank you very much for the information. And Tula, thank you for participating as well. Am I saying that name right? Tule.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. That was close.
right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to move on to item number 6, Confluence Parkway, part of our ongoing due diligence each meeting. Welcome, Michelle.
Thank you. Thank you, Rebecca. Well, good morning. Michelle Smith, Director of Hydro Licensing. I wanted today to give you an update on two things. One, I'd like to focus a little bit on some schedule updates that we've been that we've seen and received from the City of Wenatchee on the Confluence Parkway project. And then also I wanted to touch briefly on the justification letter we sent to the City of Wenatchee last week for our belief that the Horan Natural Area should receive a Category A noise designation. So I'm going to start with that, with the Category A. You know, why are we interested in this? Why is this important to the PUD? I wanted to back up just for a minute and say we have focused a lot over, well, I would say over 6 months, almost this entire year, on noise. We've been very concerned about the noise impacts associated with this parkway project being proposed by the City of Wenatchee. And we're going to great lengths to make sure that that area, the Horan Natural Area in particular, is protected and preserved, both for the public, how the public is using that area, but also to preserve the natural, kind of the unique, very unique natural area that it is today. We do understand that Federal Highway, because this project is being funded with Federal Highway funds, Federal Highway is going through the NEPA process, right? So the city and their consultants and Washington Department of Transportation are doing the legwork of this, but it's really Federal Highway NEPA process. Under that NEPA process, when they analyze noise, they put activity and land uses into categories. And so whatever category those uses fall into, that determines the appropriate amount of analysis and mitigation for noise abatement. So in this case, the Category A has a four-part test. You basically, I've got them listed here, but this was really what we answered in our letter to the City of Wenatchee, which is we believe that we can say yes to all four of these questions. We actually provided information on each one of those questions as to why we believe we could say yes to those four questions. And again, we cited our federal license, which is basically that we are obligated to protect and preserve that area as a natural area. So noise abatement is really critical for us, and to make sure, especially that inner area where we don't allow motorized vehicles and quiet and serenity is important. We were able to justify why we think all of that is important. What happens next now is we've provided that letter to the city. They will share it with Washington State Department of Transportation. It is under Federal Highway requirements. They expect the DOT to provide them a letter justifying why the area should receive Category A, and then Federal Highway makes the final determination. So our hope is that they will agree that the Horan Natural Area is Category A. It's not a given. We don't know for sure what Federal Highway will decide, but we feel that the letter we put together will serve us for many, you know, for the future, because it really does spell out the importance of preserving that area as a natural area the best we can. So that was kind of a real quick summary of all of that. Are there any questions related to the Category A or the letter that we provided? I know that was in the board packet. So
when do we hear back from that, or when do you expect?
So that will go into when all of the environmental documents are sent to Federal Highway, which I'll show the schedule in a minute when that's expected.
Oh, I see.
It'll be part of all of that.
Got it.
Packet.
Great, Gary.
I just want to comment on what a great job you've done on that letter. You were so humbled. You gave credit to a lot of your fellow staff members, and I read the letter over the weekend and reread it several times, and I just think you did a great job, your team, you and your team. Very compelling and very factual. So I want to personally thank you for your time and your effort that you've put into this. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it. The team appreciates that very much. Thank you.
Michelle, Dennis, Category A, does it just include the south side area in the Horan National Area, or does it include both sides of the river?
Very good question. I'm going to point to this map, and I know it's a little bit hard to see, but the reason we included this map, and that's a very good question, because we want to make very clear that the Horan Natural Area is a term we, in our license, is referred to as a South Confluence Park area. It's been it's been called Horan Natural Area for forever, for many, many years, and we refer to it as that. But there's different pieces of the Horan Natural Area. So the westerly side of it, where it runs directly parallel to the railroad, for example, where the loop trail is, that's called Horan Natural Area. But it's not, we're not asking for that area to be designated the same as the area where the dirt trails are, where we don't allow motorized vehicles. That is more on the easterly side of the Horan Natural Area that runs parallel more to the Columbia River and a little bit along the Wenatchee River there. But you can see it kind of highlighted in yellow on this map, and really everything along that easterly side of the area. That's, you know, we have that preserved and protected, and we manage it as a natural area. You can't have motorized vehicles in there. There's a lot of, bird species in there throughout that area. So that's really what we're speaking to here, is that area when the city completed their noise study was already a very low noise threshold. Reports came out of that area on the receptors. And so it was already categorized as Category A in the noise discipline study. So, you know, we kind of picked up on that and said, well, let's try and make sure that Federal Highway agrees with that designation.
Yeah, that's a great answer. So that area north of the Wenatchee River, which is adjacent to our new facilities being constructed, would not be considered part of A.
Correct.
Okay. Because I just didn't want us to be in a hypocritical position where we're expecting something from somebody else and not willing to mitigate it perhaps on our own.
Yes. Very good clarification.
I'm feeling better.
Thank you for bringing that up. That was a good clarification. Yeah. And so we're basically talking about that strip along the Columbia River. And here it's highlighted in yellow. That's primarily the area we're talking about.
Yeah.
Thanks, Dennis. You. Commissioners, anything else for Michelle? Oh, we're going to go. Sorry, we're going to go into the schedule there.
I thought you meant on Category A, but we'll go into the schedule.
No, I'm just rushing you right along.
This is really the project schedule that's on the city's website. So I just copied it here, but I wanted to just let you know that they're hoping to have Section 106 consultation completed the end of September. They're hoping to have their ESA consultation completed end of October. And then I mentioned this in the last board meeting. They are hoping to put the environmental assessment and the Section 4F draft documents out for public comment November 12th. It looks like that's when they're planning to distribute that. There'll be a 30-day comment period. That's when we will write our comment letter and submit that on those two documents. And then they are expecting to have an open house and a hearing on December 5th, or that week. So as soon as we know exactly when that will be, we'll make sure that you're notified. And then hoping that Federal Highway could issue their finding of no significant impact on the project, and that would wrap up NEPA around February 14th of next year. So a pretty aggressive timeline, but that's what they're hoping at this point in time. And then, of course, after Federal Highway does that, issues that FONSI, they call that, it would be sometime after that, probably within 3 to 4 months, that we'd be submitting, come back to the board, get final approval to submit something to FERC if for the land exchange if we, the board decides to pursue that as a next step. And then this is just the overall design and construction schedule, so a little bit different because this goes beyond. But, you know, 22 wraps up the environmental assessment. They're hoping, again, remember, they're only about 30% completed with design at this point, so we still have, they still have to get all the way to 100% design. The bridge design and all the permitting for the bridge and all that work will come next. And so that will continue over the next couple of years, most likely. And they need to get all the right-of-way acquisitions completed and then get their funding obligations all set, and then construction possibly 2025 is what I'm seeing there. Okay. Now, Commissioner McKenna, I'm done. So
great. Well, I guess I'm a little overly excited because I really want to confirm and support what Commissioner Arsenault said. You know, as we look at this schedule, it really reminds me how much I appreciate the effort that you and staff, other staff, are going through to keep this commission fully informed, fully participating, and allowing us to do due diligence properly on this most important decision. So it's at least for me and our, my fellow commissioners, I can speak on behalf of them. You guys are doing a great job and keeping us informed, knowledgeable. We know what's happening, what decisions are coming up, and I really, really appreciate that, those efforts. So thank you to all the staff, and it's really great. Any other questions, comments, Gary?
I appreciate your words, Steve, and I just want to go back and kind of reiterate the reason for this. I received a phone call from a constituent who was asking about KPQ article or reports on the radio and Wenatchee World stories that they've read about confusion and noise. And really, we have to go back and look at, these are our customer owners who, through our outreach transparency, have told us that noise kept coming back as this is a concern. And so what we are doing is simply listening to our constituents and our ratepayers and our customer owners and doing that due diligence work necessary to satisfy those that, what it says on the building here, customer owners own us. And so we're doing their bidding and making sure that we don't forget to turn over every single stone. And at the end of the day, that we will report to our customer owners exactly what questions they have asked us to study. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well said. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Michelle. Okay, at this time I will open it up for any public comment for anything that is not on the agenda. Is there anybody who would like to address the commissioners? Okay, I am not seeing any hands raised anywhere online. So at this point, Kirk, let's turn it over to you for manager items. We've got some time left to pick up on that before we adjourn for lunch.
That sounds great. Thank you. First, I'd like to call up Sean Smith, who's going to provide a summary of a recent outreach effort we did up in the Stehekin Valley. And we all, I think, are reminded that a very unique place and the service we provide up there has limitations. And so we always look for opportunities to get up there and talk to the community and make the community aware of some of the limitations that we have and some of the challenges we have. So, Sean.
Good morning, Commissioners. Sean Smith, Managing Director of Energy Resources. Wanted to go through our Stehekin trip, which was 1 week ago today, August 30th. We were lucky enough to have Commissioner McKenna and Commissioner Smith join us on the endeavor, along with a number of staff members. Overall, our attendance was light. We had about 8 residents that stopped by. A majority of them were part-time or seasonal. And all the comments directed towards the PUD were generally positive in nature. And, you know, they trust us as a partner and communicator on topics. A large part of that is Bob Nielsen, they say. Having him in the community is very helpful.
Just to, for those that might be listening, Bob is one of our employees up there.
Who runs everything pretty much. So
and rides an electric bike to work.
Yes, he does, around even during the winter. A little more carefully in the winter, definitely. Residents were well informed about the electrical system, and they support conservation efforts, including hot water controls, and look towards, you know, potentially knowing they'd have to convert propane and battery options. Also, you know, propane does have regular service available almost weekly, so if we had to convert some of them to propane on their water heater, that is an option. Residents do have concerns in the area about short-term rentals, code enforcement, and impacts on growth. They wanted to be protected against those impacts and didn't want to have it financially impact them due to electrical system upgrades because of that growth. The National Park Service remains prominent, so especially as it relates to road access and proposed fire camp. So they're watching those very closely. Something that came up too was Starlink is very popular up there now. They have a large number of people who have installed those and said the service is very good for them up there and able to communicate to the outside world. There is some interest we saw in solar water heating to preheat water. So that's it's not an actual solar panel where you think of where it generates electricity. This is actually heating the water before it goes into their water heater. Water heaters operate at about 4 kW, 4 kilowatts, which is close to half a load for a lot of houses. So it's quite significant. They did ask about public power benefit for funding a portion of the solution. So that came up as a topic at the end. So our next steps are we're going to put in our second newsletter of what we heard for the Stehekin community, and we'll release that. And then we're going to develop an actionable roadmap and present to the board in sometime in the fourth quarter is our current projection for that. To get it, we want to be sure we're ahead of the curve and follow that load growth, and so we're not stuck out there, you know, in a crisis mode. That's all I got, unless there are any questions.
Commissioners, any questions?
I would just like to take a second and talk a little bit about my trip to Stehekin some years ago and being a new commissioner at that time and not really fully understanding how Stehekin was off the grid. They are not connected to our hydro system in any way.
Correct.
And indeed, they're operating off of a Pelton wheel that receives its water from a glacier, which is totally fascinating. For those who might be listening out there, this is a really interesting location, interesting city, and certainly provide some interesting challenges for the district to provide electrical service in that area and in that region. And I just think that it's very unique. I'm not sure that any other entity in the state of Washington receives power in this fashion. And we've got some very creative minds that work here at the district to make all of this happen. And we have a very talented employee up in Stehekin who makes it continue to happen on a day-to-day basis. We're very fortunate to have him. He's very talented. So I just want to applaud you for all of the unique thinking that goes into maintaining not just the pelt and wheel, but also looking at, as you're talking about, solar water heaters and other methods such as propane to keep the lights on and keep the water warm for the folks up in Steakin. So thank you.
You're welcome. I'd have to give accolades to Jim White and Andrew Grissel, who are really leading that charge, along with Andy Wendell. And, you know, Commissioner Smith and I walked up all the way to the top of the penstock. And it's pretty fascinating in seeing that go, you know, all the way down, following that water that turns the wheel to provide power for the city.
Randy.
You know, just first I want to say thank you to the district for encouraging me to go participate. It renewed, how do I say this? I've lived here my entire life, and Steakin has always held somewhat of a magical place in the longtime residents' minds. You know, Steakin's a special place in Chelan County. I renewed that conversation after coming back with the guys that I hang out with at coffee sometimes in the morning, only to find out that mythical place in the minds of long-timers still exists. And so I think that's special for us, you know, to understand how Steakin relates to the rest of Chelan County. It was a great opportunity to converse, and I have to say that, if you know, encourage people to go up there and just hang out at the bakery. That's a great place to hang out. They do a great job inside the bakery, along with having a nice yard outside. Mm-hmm. So, but no, that for me, it was a reminder of my childhood, if you will, going up there as a kid. So, anyway.
Sean, in reflecting comments that I received from the limited folks that we had, I was curious about why that was happening. And, you know, and I've thought about that over the week, and here's my summary of that. In the conversations that I had, I think there was such a great deal of information that people were aware of. For example, the implications on the battery investigation that was done to utilize that electricity, you know, in the evening. Even though that generated a lot of excitement up there, when they looked at the numbers and the data, et cetera, they could see that, okay, so we need to ratchet down from that. We need to get to some very practical solutions on water heaters, et cetera. The level of knowledge that people had on what staff have been doing and looking at was very high. And so I want to commend staff on the communication with our customer owners up there. That was my takeaway in reflecting coming back down from my visit up there, and which was kind of confirmed that we need to take those very small, again, those very small specific steps on conservation, because we've got to do that in order to show, if we've got to take any other steps down the road, everything that we've done to try to provide the resiliency and affordability and access to electricity up there on an ongoing basis. So staff are doing a great job, and I appreciate that. And it was a good learning for me, because it kind of caught me off guard a little bit. Like, where are our regulars? But when I really listened to the folks that we did talk to, I was impressed with how much they were knowledgeable and aware. So I think that's my takeaway, whatever that's worth.
That's wonderful to hear, and we'll keep communicating with them to that level. Yep. That they need to make informed choices.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Sean.
Thanks, Sean.
Next, I'd like to ask John Goodwill to come up and provide an update on some of the road improvement work we have going on out at the vicinity of the new service center.
Good morning, commissioners, staff. John Goodwill, project manager. I'm here to share about a project that's getting kicked off next week. The Technology Center Way project is our traffic mitigation for the new service center. And this effort started a couple years back. We got together with the city of Wenatchee and WashDOT and put together with one of our consultants, did a traffic impact analysis, figured out how, you know, the new service center and all the various employees that are going to be coming there would impact this area for traffic, came up with these mitigation measures, and now we're going to execute the work. So Smith Excavation is going to start next week. We got a pre-con going Thursday. We got a lot of players involved. We got the city of Wenatchee. We got WashDOT. Zipley Communications got to do a little relocation in there. And so we got quite a bit going on. The essence of the project is going to be about a month and a half. We're going to start mid-September. By mid-October, we should be ready to do paving on this new section. So you can see on the map, the extension takes Technology Way to Easy Street. And one of the big...
John, you might want to move the mouse so you can kind of point or Rebecca can.
So right here, is that showing up?
Yep, that's it.
So that's the new Technology Way extension. And what that's going to do is we're also taking Easy Street. One of the nice things we had is a lot of width on this Easy Street off-ramp going to Penny Road. And we're utilizing that width, taking away the fog lane on both sides, and we're putting in a southbound lane. So that's pretty exciting. A little bit nerve-wracking for folks like me thinking about traffic. But what we're going to do is you'll see this black line here all along. It's hard with the mouse to track it, but that's going to be a curb delineator.
Where's your mouse at?
Top. Okay, look up here by Penny Road.
Top left, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You got it? Oh, thank you. So that southbound lane is going to be delineated with a curb, a plastic curb. So think about the south end of Wenatchee with those delineators as it merges into Mission and Chelan, but with a nice curb on it, you know, on top of a curb. And so what that'll do is that'll allow folks that want to come in from the north, come in down and connect and take a left onto left onto the new Technology Way. So that's really the essence of the traffic mitigation, was putting that in. That's like the real winner on getting traffic flow not to back up in this general area. So it will be a new getting used to out there for sure.
I'm just looking at that. As a guy that will come in from the north a lot, thank you. Start with it.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm surprised down there at the corner that it's not a roundabout.
So we looked at a roundabout. That was definitely something we looked at. And it just, when you look at the traffic models, it would not have been good, and especially because you had the potential of backing up into the highway. That's a big deal. So what you have here is you have a free right turn lane. So it's going to be basically, you'll be getting off. It's a lot like it is now, two lanes. And then the other thing, if you scroll up, I don't know if they can see it, we're closing off Horan Road, or scroll down, sorry, wrong direction. We're closing off the Horan on-ramp, which, by the way, for somebody who spends a lot of time driving out there, is dangerous, I feel. And so when you want to go right on this new tech way, it's going to be a free right turn. There's not going to be a stop sign or anything to back you up. And then there's a throughway. There's nothing to stop you going straight through. And then there's plenty of, if we scroll back down, there's plenty of space if traffic does back up on this new southbound lane. There's tons of space there, which the models don't say it's going to back up much, but that's really where the bang for the buck is out there. The other essence of this is Chester Kim. That can be a little bit of mess later in the day. And there's going to be put a sign there. Now, we all know not everybody follows signs, but we're going to try to see if it works. And it's basically saying during certain hours, you can't turn a left there. The city is going to keep their eye on that. And if things get out of hand, they'll put in a concrete curb delineator. So they're hoping we don't have to do that. But they'll keep their eye out on that. And one of the key parts of this... The nice thing is that the Technology Way part, the big part of the construction, that new road, it's really not going to impact traffic much during construction. That's really good. And then there's going to be a two-week outage of the highway off-ramp. It's going to be closed. And the nice thing about that, that'll happen around mid-October. Folks can just go to the next off-ramp. And so it's not going to be a big impact, really. So we got a permit with WSDOT to do that. We got traffic control plans approved. So we're all ready to rock and roll. Before I wanted to bring Suzanne up because we've been doing a lot of outreach. And Suzanne's heading up that effort. We've been tapping in her knowledge. But before she starts, would you guys, you can come on up, Suzanne. Do you guys have any questions about the logistics, the construction part of this project?
Well, maybe not the construction, but the road itself. Maybe you said it and I missed it. What property, I mean, who owns the property? Where are you getting the access?
So this is a City of Wenatchee-owned right-of-way. Several years back, the city purchased that right-of-way and had in their long-range plans to install this extension. Well, this project, you know, expedited that project.
This is a big plus.
Yeah. It's going to be good. It's going to really help. So, you know, it's going to have a traffic island. It'll be a free right turn. If you're going west, there'll be a free right turn. You know, we really took the time and effort and worked together with WSDOT and City to come up with the best approach, and I think it's going to be good. I really do.
I have a quick question before you move on. Which road, would it be Technology Center Way or Penny Road, would be the most likely pathway if someone was going to go down past the Washington State Patrol and get on Highway 2? At that juncture, where did they go?
They would most likely either go Technology Way and then go, right, it spins up to Penny or Chester Kinn to Penny Road.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah. So that's the thing we looked at. There's a lot of different routes now. That southbound lane's big for the northbound traffic. And our trucks, we're going to figure out what's best for our trucks and our equipment, you know, that moves in and out, our service vehicles. It gives them a lot of options. So, yeah.
Well, it all looks good on paper, doesn't it? And the proof will be in the pudding, of course, informing customer owners and the employers out there, the employees out there. So we've been working closely with the City of Wenatchee and with the Washington Department of Transportation to ensure that the information gets out. And couple of things. The brochure that you received will be going out this week and delivering those to employers in the area, all the way up really to where the cinema is at that mall area. We'll be delivering the brochure and letting them know that this is coming very soon, mid-September. And then we'll also be sending emails to all of we. They're on our customer owner list, and we'll be sending emails to all of them, again, attaching the brochure. They can forward it on to their employees or copy it themselves if they run out of ones that we deliver. And Rachel is going to be doing a lot of media outreach, and even perhaps we talked about having a little tour for, say, Wenatchee World or NCW Life to come out and see firsthand what we're talking about on the ground. So there's going to be a number of ways that we will try to help those who will be using that area and letting them know how to figure it out, how to navigate and where to go for information. And Mario and I will go out tomorrow, and Mario Cantu has graciously offered his services to if people have questions who may not be bilingual, to get in touch with him. So,
one other thing I wanted to add, I'm pretty excited. We got a really good bid on this project, and that's saying a lot these days with the inflation and stuff. So really excited about that. And a good contractor. Smith Excavation, there's no relation, right?
Nope, there isn't. I know them all.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to working with them. We've had good success with them on several projects. So,
is the right, as you're heading north on Chester, is that a right only?
It's you cross? You're going to be able to cross, okay. But it's going to be signed with a limiting movements during a certain time of the day. So, like the morning rush hour and the afternoon rush hour. We'd like people to turn right there and not left because you can really back up traffic there. But, you know, this new connection is going to alleviate a lot of that traffic. They're going to go on that new connection, go straight down north on Easy Street and out.
I bet Jeffers will enjoy that road so they're not cutting through their parking lot.
It's basically a road right now through their parking lot. Yep. I think they've said they've counted it. They've had over 100 vehicles through there a day, something like that.
Yeah,
they mentioned how they've counted those traffic. That's a lot.
Commissioners, we should probably mention that Jeffers and their team have been involved in this and yeah. with the city and our team. I've had several conversations with Todd Keyes and Evan and the rest. So they've been involved, and thanks to our team for outreaching with them.
Yeah, we secured a small right-of-way acquisition. If you go back to the drawing, you'll see that right turn. There's just a little piece of that corner that we had procured, and then we got a temporary construction easement for them, and we worked hard on that for quite a while, didn't we, Eric?
Yep. A lot of work. Yeah. But actually a really
worked out good.
Really good problem-solving attitudes by everyone going in and trying to find the right best outcome for all the folks out there. So really pleased with the outcome and the participation.
Just sort of a surprising note. I drive by there quite frequently. There still is a vacant lot right there.
Yes. Oh, wait, no. You know what? This actually, there's a building there. It's Northwest Agriculture. No, it's a credit union. Mm-hmm. You know what? That's scroll down a little bit. Yeah, there's a building there. This is an old image. The RH2 put this exhibit together, and they pulled up an old image. Yes, there is the Northwest Credit Union, if I recall.
Or is it Northwest Farm Credit?
That's it. That's it, yeah. Okay. There is a building there.
Okay. Okay. Steve. Gary?
Can you help me envision the truck route? So I'm probably going to be asked this at my next grocery store encounter. So we've got service trucks that are coming in and out. We're aware from our studies that the majority of our traffic is actually heading either west on Highway 2 or up 97 towards Lake Chelan.
Correct.
So can you help me envision where the truck traffic is likely to be here, especially if...
Coming or going? Or
both, because yeah. What I'm hearing you say is that left turns on Penny Road won't necessarily be possible.
Yeah.
So that leaves the Technology Center Way connector, number 3,
right,
if you're wanting to go to Cashmere or Leavenworth.
Yes.
So can you walk me through this?
Yeah, I think you're going to see the majority of the truck traffic, our larger vehicles, heading out this new connection and taking that free right turn, and then also coming in and taking that left turn. On that new southbound lane. I think you're going to see a pretty significant portion. To Chelan, honestly, because there's going to be a new roundabout. You guys know about that. That's coming next year with WashDOT. I would think that Penny Road or that Penny Road out by the State Patrol would be more typical for our trucks. But what we did is we secured by securing that right away from Daniel's WJDSA law, it's wide enough now with a free turn that our trucks are going to be able to make that turn. And then the left turn, you might get queued up there. You know, there's quite a bit of traffic on that off ramp. So you might have to wait just a little bit there. But the mornings are the worst for sure. And they're not going that direction. They're coming back in the afternoons that direction. So I think you're going to see, you know, the models say that it's kind of a split, like a 50-50. But I just have a feeling that's going to be a little more on the tech way. But we'll see.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you both.
Suzanne, good seeing you.
Next, I'd like to invite Kyle Endelman up, who's going to give us all an update on the Chelan River Whitewater Boating event for this year.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Kyle. I'm the North End Park Superintendent. So my areas are Rocky Reach and then the Chelan area. So I wanted to give a quick update on our whitewater boating event that's coming up. It's coming up in about 2 weeks. Takes place in the Chelan River Gorge. Before I get too into this, I wanted to just remind everyone that this is an expert-only whitewater boating event. So this is Class 5 Plus. It is not open to the general public. We have worked with American Whitewater to come up with a system where they will rate their members, and they won't let anybody that is not qualified to be on the river get on the river in coordination with us. We also have a sign-up. You have to sign up and sign a waiver to be able to participate in this event. So it is coming up in a couple weekends. We have a release on 2 days, Saturday and Sunday. Saturday is kind of the more moderate event, 375 CFS. And then Sunday is, you know, kind of our big event. So we typically would get about half the participants go on Sunday. So it's quite a bit harder, and, you know, a lot of the people that participate on Saturday do not want to participate on Sunday. So on a good weekend, we will get about 50 people on Saturday, and then, you know, roughly half that for Sunday. We have been talking with Whitewater Association, and it does look like this year participation may be down a little bit, and that is largely due to the fact that the rivers have been running very high this spring and summer. So they're tired. Usually this event kind of it hits at a time period where the rivers are all low and they're kind of desperate for kind of a last end of season run. So but this year we'll see. But online signups have been pretty slow and low, but kind of typical with this group. We get a lot of last minute folk here. This event is part of our license requirement. When we first started off, we did this event 6 weekends a year, and we've kind of worked with American Whitewater to kind of reduce and kind of condense the run. So now we just do the one weekend. And we will release water even if there's only one boater, although American Whitewater wants at least two on the water for safety reasons. Here you can kind of see the course. The boaters put in right below the dam, they get out at Powerhouse Park. It's about 3 miles, give or take. However, the part that they enjoy is only it's less than a half mile long. So it's basically from daybreak down. So, and that's where you get the big water. It will usually take them 3 to 5 hours to get through. It does take a while. They do they do kind of congregate at the rapids. Just a quick picture of kind of what they're facing. This is actually, I believe, on a Saturday, so this is a little bit lower flow right there. And with that, does anybody have any questions?
No questions, but maybe a comment. Is this Chelan County's equivalent to the OMAC suicide rate?
Yeah, I believe it is.
Yeah.
Kyle, how do you handle spectators? Where do they go, and how is that handled?
Spectators are allowed up on the Gorge Road, so they can watch from up there. In years past, we have actually had a spectator release form. However, that was very hard to monitor. How do you get that out? So when we'd see people, we'd have them sign a waiver. We we've kind of done away with that. So now they're able to look, you know, kind of above daybreak. There's that little overlook, and that's where most spectators hang out. But last year, there wasn't very many. There was maybe a dozen.
I see.
And most of those were related to the participants.
Any other questions or comments for Kyle?
I just want to say it looks like a lot of fun, and maybe if I was about 20 or 30 years younger, I might actually participate in something like that. I've kayaked down the Rogue River, but not to that extent. That's pretty amazing.
It is quite amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much. Right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kyle. I'd like to invite Justin Erickson up, who's going to give us an update on Riverfront Park Planning Open House.
Good morning, Commissioners. Justin Erickson, Managing Director for District Services. It's my pleasure this morning to just give you a quick update on our Riverfront Park planning efforts. This is a joint project between the district and the city of Wenatchee. And you might recall about 9 months ago, the master plan was adopted by this board and the city council. And shortly thereafter, we engaged with our consultant team to carry the design forward for the first phase. So we're in the process of getting to a 30% design by the end of this year, moving on to a full design and hopefully a bid package in 2023. So as part of this effort, we did anticipate one additional opportunity for public comment and we're at a kind of a critical juncture where we're evaluating some concepts at some key locations along the first phase. These relate to the splash pad, playground, picnic pavilion, trail enhancements, and a few other details. And so next week on both Tuesday and Wednesday, we will be holding open houses. We have the opportunity along the trail to do this a little bit uniquely and take it and also I think advantageously, because we've got you might recall last year we did outreach and had a very warm reception from the public. We held those outreach events at PIBUS. What we're going to do this year is keep that theme, have the session at PIBUS, but then also utilize two satellite locations along the trail so people can actually experience the proposed enhancements in the spaces that they're designed in. And so in addition to PIBUS, we will be setting up a booth at the pedestrian, where the pedestrian bridge intersects with the trail. There near the train depot, and then further north, we will have one just north of the 5th Street roundabout, and that will be the location of the planned splash pad. So on Tuesday, September 13th, from 4 till 7, all three locations will be open and available for the public, and then we'll do the same thing the following morning from 7 a.m. until 10 a.m. And so we're hoping to engage with the public, get some feedback, that will help us as we get to a good preferred design. What I'd like to do, just very briefly, is run you through a couple of quick scenarios related to the splash pad to give you an example of the types of images and the types of decisions that we have before us. So next slide, or I'll move this. There we go. Okay. So please note that these are preliminary, and the ones that are shown next week may be slightly different because our design team is making final changes as we speak. But this will give you an example of what we're going to share and design. You'll see a splash pad that's really more of a spray park or a splash park. Has a more urban feel to it than what you would see certainly at the splash pad at Kiwanis, at Rotary Park, or what's being constructed now at Lincoln Park by the city of Wenatchee. So this is one concept we want to get feedback on. Concept number two is utilizing the historical reference to the steamships that were manufactured and launched in this area. So you'll see something here that harkens to that past and is probably a bit more traditional when we think of a splash pad. And so so three very, very diverse concepts.
Does that concept cut right through the sidewalk?
This one does cut right through one of the small pathways.
It's heavily used by some people.
Yes, yes. And we've talked about that. That is one drawback.
No, that's okay, though.
Yeah. And like you might imagine, with so many concepts, the final concept may be a blend of more than one of these concepts as well. So we know that we'll get feedback that where people may like portions of one concept and portions of another.
Justin, question on this concept: are kids able to get into the water? So it's not a splash pad per se. Then water's not shooting up. That sort of thing.
In this concept, there would be some spray. I think in that lower right photo, you can see some. So you can imagine someone standing in here and then getting splashed on. But it is different than what you might traditionally think of when you think of a splash park.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. So we look forward to getting the word out about this event, and I look forward to sharing with you updates and on the feedback that we receive, and we'll be coming back to the board later on this fall as we get closer on the plan development. Are there any questions?
Yeah. Dennis?
Yeah, Justin, would you mind emailing me those three concepts?
Absolutely. I'll do that right after.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you.
Not that I have a vested interest.
We saw the clapping.
Well, I was hoping so.
Is the third option that you showed, is that more of a river concept of kids getting into the river and playing in the water, but it's actually moving in a direction? Is that?
You know, it's a good question in terms of the slope to it. I think there's different ways we could design that. Yeah, I think the way it's shown there is a very gentle slope. So it would not be sort of like a lazy river type situation. But if your feet were in there, you would probably feel a light current. But that we're kind of playing with the terrain there, which is relatively flat. So we wouldn't we didn't anticipate a ton of movement. We also have some restrictions in that area. There's a sanitary sewer line that goes through there. And so, so we're kind of working around that with this design as well.
Great. Thank you. Okay. Anything else? Justin, thank you very much.
Got one more, but we can do that after.
Okay. So at this time, we will recess for lunch, and we'll be back at 1 p.m. Good afternoon. Welcome to September 6, 2022 business session of the Chelan Public Utility District Commission meeting. I'd like to remind everyone this afternoon to please silence any electronic devices that you have with you today, and for those participating online to mute your screens. Excuse me. Welcome the public's input at our meetings and remind you that these meetings are recorded. If you wish to address any item on the agenda, please raise your hand either physically or electronically to let us know that you wish to speak. When recognized, please state your name and address for the record and limit your comment to 3 minutes. Commissioners, we have a consent agenda in front of us. Is there a motion to accept the consent agenda, including resolutions 10 and 11?
I would move to approve the consent agenda, including those two resolutions, 10 and 11.
I would second.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes. So at this time, I'd like to welcome our friends from Washington PUD Association who are here to visit with us. We have Stephanie and Nicholas.
Liz.
Or Liz. Sorry.
Oh, that's okay.
I didn't look at my list. But anyway, welcome. And Gary's going to shift and sit.
Different hat.
Sit with a different side of the table today. So welcome, Mr. President of WPUDA, and glad you're joining us. And I'll turn it over to the three of you.
Well, thank you. I want to start by thanking Chelan PUD and each of you in this room, and even some that are absent from this room, for your participation in the association. We could not exist without you. You are the essence of what makes us successful. Of course, my name is Gary Arsenault. I am the board president at Waputa. I'm joined today by Liz Anderson, who is the deputy executive director, and also Nicholas Garcia, who is with us today. I think you've been through almost all of them except the last meeting that we had over in Kitsap. Nicholas is the policy director for Waputa. You're going to be hearing from all of us today, but mostly these folks here because they play such an important role in making us all successful. We've come today for two reasons, really. The first and most important is to listen. We would like to hear what Chelan PUD has to say about the organization, areas that we can improve, areas that we can provide value. But the second reason that we're here today is to also then share with you some of the resources and assets that the association has and makes available, not just to commissioners. As commissioners, we're all familiar with the meetings and the topics and the things that we cover, but also to general manager and right on through to staff at staff level within all of the PUDs and the resources that we can bring to bear to help this organization become more successful and to be more efficient by not duplicating expenses in education. You'll hear all about that today. You'll also hear about the efforts that Waputa brings to the legislative front and helping bring unity to topics that we all benefit from. There is strength in numbers, no doubt about that. I will share with you something that these folks have heard me say at every PUD, and the illustration really is at Pacific PUD, their concern might involve something along the lines of tsunamis and how to protect and rebuild after an event such as that. Now, as a small PUD out on the coast, it's difficult for them to grab the ear of the legislators. We, at Chelan PUD, we have significant interest in wildfire legislation. And while Pacific may not have much concern about wildfires, they are part of this association. And they will and have supported Chelan PUD and the other PUDs in Eastern Washington on wildfire legislation, just as we would step forward to support them on tsunami legislation. That proves my point, their strength in numbers. And as an association, that is only one of the many benefits that we bring to bear for all 28 PUDs in the state of Washington. So, as the new president, relatively new president of Waputa, my theme, which followed much in the footsteps of Commissioner Smith's theme in terms of getting to know you, mine is titled Reuniting Our Public Utility Districts. We've just come through a COVID period of history that is unlike none other in recent memory. We've all been living in little windows and boxes. It's very difficult to get to know your fellow commissioners or even the Waputa staff if all you do is live in a window in a box. So now that COVID has gotten a little bit more under control and we're able to get out in front of folks and shake hands, we're here today to talk about reuniting all of our PUDs for exactly the reason I mentioned earlier, and that's the strength in numbers. And in terms of reuniting the PUDs, we also have to understand the benefits and values. What's been going on behind the screen, that little screen, for 2 years? What has Waputa been developing in the way of resources and assets? And you'll hear that today. There's been a lot of work being done. These folks have not been sitting idle. They have been very, very busy. Just like Santa's workshop, right?
Right. Without the funny hats and the little pointy shoes.
Yeah. Exactly. So, the other value that is being created here is that over this two-year period of COVID, we've had a significant number of new commissioners come on board, and general managers for that matter. And they have not had the benefit of exposure to Waputa. So we're coming out into the field, and we're taking that proactive approach. We're visiting each of the 28 PUDs in an effort to reignite that interest in the organization
and to deepen and strengthen the bond that really bonds all of us together. We're in this industry. So I deviated from my normal speech, but I felt that it was important to really get on topic. And what I'd like to do now is I'd like to turn it over to Liz and Nicholas. You're going to hear about Nicholas and the deep relationships he has developed at the legislature and the access that he has to legislators so that he has an ear. And that ear is going to be talking what interests all of us collectively as a PUD. So, Liz and Nicholas, take it away.
All right. Thank you, Mr. President, and thank you, commissioners, for giving us the opportunity to come and meet with you. It's good to see so many people in person. We've missed all of you. And I wanted to start off expressing our gratitude for the contributions that this PUD makes to the association. I look around the room and on the little screen in front of me, and I see the leadership you have provided over the years. You have an incredible staff who has been very engaged in the association and very willing to assist us in our endeavors. And we greatly appreciate the work that you do to support the association. We are going to talk a little bit about the resources that we provide in services, and the reason why we decided to do this, and I think our president stated this quite well, is the fact that we have been apart and we have new faces, and we realized in the course of connecting with our PUDs that not everybody knew they had resources available to them through the association. So we thought, well, we better make sure that everybody is aware of those resources so you're able to maximize the value of the association. But as our president mentioned, we also want to hear from you. All the resources that we provide are in direct response to the needs of our members. And so if there's something missing, we're here to help, and we want to make sure we're providing that value. So I'm going to start off with our contact information. If you don't have us on speed dial, there you go. Many of you do. I wanted to just throw up some facts about her history, and I feel a little intimidated knowing that Commissioner Bowles is on this meeting, and he is our resident expert, our historian on PUDs. So I am going to try to get this right, but boy, if I get anything wrong, Commissioner Bowles, please let me know. The reason why I wanted to start with our history is because it really has a bearing on how we function today as an association. We were formed in 1936, so 6 years after Initiative Number 1 passed, allowing for the formation of public utility districts. And at the time, there were several PUDs that were already formed. The Washington State Grange that led the PUD movement continued to be active in supporting the formation of PUDs. And in 1936, which was a significant year because it was the year there was a constitutional challenge to the PUD law. So the Grange Master called together the commissioners of the existing PUDs and basically handed the reins of leadership over to the elected commissioners and said, we've done all this great work to provide this opportunity for communities to own and operate their own utilities, but we need you to work together and advocate for formation of PUDs. That really was the focus back then. So that began the Washington PUD Commissioners Association. And the Washington State Grange did a lot of incredible things, brilliant things, in the formation of the PUD law and the campaign to get that law put into place. And this was one of the really smart things that they did, bringing together the elected commissioners and having them work cooperatively together. Because I think even back then, they recognize the voices of elected commissioners, when they speak in unison, are very powerful. And they knew that was going to be important to the viability of the PUDs going forward. So the original purpose was to support activation of PUDs, but the direction changed in the early 1950s. And that's because there was recognition by the association that there needed to be a focus on operational excellence. PUDs had to do a great job of serving their communities, because if they didn't, that opened the door for opponents of PUDs to come in and try to restrict their authority their ability to serve their communities. And we've actually seen that, those attempts over the history of PUDs. So at that time, the resources, the services changed. And that's where you saw the training come in, the information sharing. And that's when the name changed to the Washington PUD Association. So a few factoids on our history to set the stage. So that brings us to our mission today. We're here to support you, to make sure that you have the resources to be successful in serving your communities. Our services basically fall into these four buckets: advocacy, training, education, collaboration, and information sharing, and policy research and analysis. If you haven't seen these folks, I'd be surprised. They are our Waputa team, and probably these faces are familiar to many of you. There's one thing that we all agree on. These photos are woefully out of date. We don't all look like that any longer, but some of us really want to update these pictures. Some just want to leave them alone. So, the bottom line, though, is these are dedicated professionals that are here to assist. So you can contact anyone on staff, and if they don't have the answer to your question or if they can't help you, they'll find the person who can, and we'll make sure you get the information and support that you need. So the association is still a commissioner-driven organization. That's really a reflection on our history back in 1936. The board of directors sets the strategic direction. The board is made up of elected commissioners. And you have a voice on that board. You're able to have input on the strategic direction. Our executive committee, our executive officers, are elected commissioners. And I know several in this room have served in that capacity, and we greatly appreciate it. Our policy committees, I know your staff and commissioners and manager participate in our policy committee meetings, where we're really able to discuss and vet the issues that are impacting PUDs and come up with a strategic way to address those issues. There are a variety of other committees, and we also have professional roundtables, which we really encourage. If you have staff members who aren't participating in these, and I think for the most part you are, to take advantage of that. They usually run around a day and a half, and it really gives these different professional groups an opportunity to get together and share information, participate in training. And I have a list of the groups coming up in another slide. So we have our meetings. I know you're all very aware of our meeting schedule. And the one thing that I'd like to highlight on this slide is that all of your staff members are welcome to our meetings. So if you have someone new coming on board and maybe they're not familiar with PUDs, they're new to PUDs, or maybe they are new to your PUD, they're welcome to sit in on any of our meetings. It's a great way to kind of onboard your staff members and get them up to speed on all the issues that are important, not just to Chelan County PUD, but to PUDs across the state. So we welcome that. We do a lot of work, as you know, on the advocacy front at Waputa on both the state and the federal level. And Nicholas and I were just talking about this earlier. More and more, there's quite a bit of workload happening in the regulatory space that we are engaged in. So I thought this would be a really good time to hand it over to Nicholas and talk a little bit more about that. Before I do that, I just want to emphasize that the policy direction for Waputa is set by the members. So you have a voice in our priorities, our legislative priorities, and again, we're here to lend our support, and we do that with one common voice. So with that, I'm going to hand over to Nicholas to talk a little bit about what we have been doing.
So, good afternoon, everyone. And again, thank you for having us. This is actually a very, very useful endeavor that we're going that we've undertaken on behalf of the staff. It's useful for us because we really sometimes get a little bit siloed ourselves in terms of being able to make sure that we understand what the directives are from our association, which way to go, and having these sorts of conversations really kind of opens up the channels of communication, which really makes our work clearer for how we approach various policy issues. I was going to describe one issue that I know is near and dear to your all's heart, or Chelan County PUD's heart, that happened last year. And just to kind of give you a sense of how we approach issues and to make sure you understand that what we do is at your behest. And we, you know, I have my own opinions on issues. I'm sure Liz has her own opinions on issues. But they take a back seat to what the association's policies and positions are on issues. And it is our job to stand up in front of the legislature and in front of regulatory agencies and in front of other policy-making bodies and just in general public bodies to basically articulate your needs and your positions on issues. So the issue was the wildfire issue, the rule that came out, or excuse me, the draft legislation that came out last year. So you probably all know the history, but I'm going to go through it really briefly. There was an article in the Seattle Times, and they looked at what was going on in California in terms of wildfires and utility responsibility, and made some assertions about things that were going on, incorrect assertions, I would say, in Washington State. A legislator, Senator Rolfes, saw that on a Sunday morning article. She directed her staff to write a bill to deal with that issue. And that bill was entitled, I'm paraphrasing here, but making utilities presumptively responsible for wildfires that occur in Washington State, which was obviously, just the title itself was highly, highly charged. And the information in the bill, the requirements of the bill were equally as terrifying. So the bill came out, was dropped on Tuesday. What it mean by dropped is was made available on Tuesday. On Thursday, she held her first public meeting. So between the time it was dropped and it became available to us and the following 2 days, there was no way that the association could have reasonably reached out to everyone and say, well, what position should we take on this issue? You know, how should we respond? Rather, we look to our strategic plan. And the strategic plan has been adopted by the members of the association as the guiding principles for how we approach issues. And looking at that strategic plan and looking at the bill, we were able to form a response. But it was more than just a response. We came out strongly opposed to the bill, just so everyone knows. I don't think it's a surprise, but we basically said this is really bad. But the immediately thing we did after that is we reached out to the author, the main author. And one of the things you should know about Senator Rolfes is she's the third-ranking member of the House, of the Washington State Senate, which means she has enough pull in that body that if she wants a bill passed, it will get passed. So for us, what we needed to do is figure out, well, what was she really needed and what she really wanted? And we reached out to her and started a couple-week conversation about what was it that was really important to her. And during that process, one of the things that became clear is that she did not really understand how important wildfires were to us. And I mean important in a terrible way. And, you know, what we were able to point out to her is that this is an existential threat to our very existence. You know, if the wildfire comes, it can destroy our total ability to provide power, and it can wipe us out financially. But then we said, and what your bill will do is make it so onerous and so expensive to get insurance that we're going to either not be able to get it or it's going to have a significant rate impacts. And once we were able to kind of explain what was going on, what really implications of her bill were, and to demonstrate that this is something we are not like what was going on in California. We take wildfires seriously. We work really hard to prevent it, and we didn't oppose an approach that could help us achieve that end. And by working with her, we were able to come up with some legislation that Waputa eventually supported that would have established the requirement to do mitigation plans, but that included enough flexibility that the mitigation plan that was going to be implemented by Pacific County PUD, which is has a very different topography, very different vegetation, very different density than Chelan County PUD and Ponderay County PUD and Whatcom County PUD and so on and so forth. You could design the system that was appropriate to your particular circumstances. And we felt that that was incredibly important. Now, you might say, well, why did you support any bill? This is something that we didn't want and we don't need. And this gets back to the political reality, is she was the third ranking member of the Senate. Since she wanted a bill, a bill was going to pass. The question is, well, could we make it as utility friendly as possible? And I in my opinion, and you know, I obviously can't speak for anyone on the board, but I think we achieved that largely. Now, the bill eventually didn't pass. And it didn't pass for reasons that have nothing to do with wildfire. It has to do with House-Senate differences and issues. But we have been working with Senator Rolfes in the interim, and we've been working with DNR in the interim to try to get a handle on this issue so that when it comes back, and it will come back, we can start off one with a much better bill, we hope. And we've basically said, look, let's work together. And we have reminded the senator several times about the importance of working together, which is going to be my second point. As much as I would love to say that Waputa, on its own, was able to affect this change, we work with all members of the PUD community, excuse me, of the electric utility community. We have to. We work with the IOUs. We work with the municipals, with Seattle, Tacoma, Richland, and many other smaller municipals, and we work with the co-ops. And we have to work with all of them if we're going to be effective. We do have one great advantage. Of those subsectors, we provide more power than anyone else, slightly more than the IOUs. We provide about, and this was a couple years old data, so it might be a little out of date, but 38% of the power delivered to retail customers, industrial, commercial, and residential in this state is delivered by PUDs. 37% is delivered by IOUs. 22%, I believe, is delivered by municipals, and the remainder is by co-ops. So we are collectively the biggest of the utility subsector. The good news in all that is that gives us some clout, but the bad news is that's not enough, and we do have to work with our compatriots, and we work very hard to do that. I'm going to change for just on one moment to another issue that has just come up. We learned 2 weeks ago, 2.5 weeks ago, about the ambient heat rule, which some of you may have heard, where the Department of Labor and Industries wants to establish a new rule that would limit the amount of exposure utility workers or any workers have to high temperatures. And in their mind, high temperatures is above 80 degrees. And I'm going to repeat what others have speculated. I don't have any specific information on this, but others have speculated that this is largely a farm worker issue. But the rules will encompass anyone who works outside, including utility workers. And what we pointed out in the last meeting is that we deliver a vital public service. If it is broken, it needs to get fixed, and it needs to get fixed fast, especially when it's really hot out, because that's when people are in danger. And so it's very important that we have some carve-out that allow us to deal with emergency circumstances in order to protect our communities. And, excuse me, they seem to have understood that, and there seemed to be some receptivity to that. We also pointed out that sometimes it's not just a community issue, it's a small issue. This actually happened in Olympia, where I live. Some power lines fell down over a street, and some live wires fell over cars that had been driving, and there were people inside the cars. And we pointed out that in that situation, we have to get the people out. We have to get them out now. And if it's over 80 degrees, we're not going to stop. And, you know, because there's a 15-minute cool-down period, we have to get this. It's a matter of absolute exigent circumstance that those people need to be removed from the cars in a safe way. And so we were bringing these sorts of examples to LNI's attention, along with all other utilities. And this includes water utilities and wastewater, anyone who works outside. If you have a broken system, a broken utility, it has community impact. And we're working hard right now with not just PUDs, but with everyone to try to help LNI understand that their issue needs to be looked at in the broader context of public value for the citizens of the state. So that's kind of what we do and how we go about doing it. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and if not, I will turn it back over to Liz.
All right. Up on your screen is just a list of some of the services. I'm sure I forgot a few things that we do. And basically our focus is connecting you to the processes that happen in Olympia and Washington, D.C. without you having to be in Olympia and Washington, D.C. So we try to make sure that you have the communications, the information that's going to keep you connected, and in turn allow you to give us your informed opinions about these issues so we can engage. So with that, I think I'll move to the next slide here. We do a lot in the field of training and education, and again, you're probably very familiar with many of the programs that we offer. Those roundtables for utility professional staff, again, if you have staff members who can attend those, they typically run, again, about a day and a half, and it's a really good time for folks to get together and share information. The one thing about being a member of the PUD family is we can, I'm going to say this, I hope I say this correctly, admire and acquire. So we can shamelessly steal from each other, and so that helps us to be very efficient in what we do, and we can exchange that information in those roundtables. We also do a lot in the field of collaboration information sharing, and Nicholas, I thought, did a nice job of talking about how we work with others within the utility industry, but we have those relationships elsewhere as well. We work with our local government group. It's everyone from the Association of Washington Cities, the counties, the fire districts. We get together with them on a quarterly basis, so we share information. We just recently became a member of the National Special Districts Coalition. So these are special districts from across the United States. So now we have another means to influence federal legislation that impacts special districts. We started working with them during COVID when we were seeking to get direct allocations of federal funds to the PUDs, and we've continued that relationship. And then we have our opportunities to share information through our annual conference, our workshops. We have our water workshop coming up this month, and I hope everybody can make it to our annual conference because we'll be back live in person this year. And the other thing I wanted to point out is that we have survey information available. So we have quite a list of surveys we have compiled that answer questions that are posed by utilities. So if you're seeking a certain document, we're looking for a policy on this, or how do you deal with this issue? We will survey our PUDs. We compile that into a report, which we return to the requesting PUD, but we also archive it. And so you have access to all that information. And typically, when we get a question, we're able to immediately send a report out to the requesting PUD because we've done a survey on that. So that's a resource that we encourage you to use.
So if I could?
Yes.
And two things about that. One, we use that for regulatory purposes as well. When we were doing looking for arrearage support from the state legislature, we asked a couple different times what your arrearage situation was, and yours and the other utilities responded very helpfully. And we found out that at one point it almost topped $400 million for all water, electric, wastewater, and telecommunications utilities. It went down a little bit by the end of last year. It was, I think, $270 million. And the legislature basically used that information as one of the bases for appropriating $100 million arrearage support. So it's very helpful for us on a regulatory basis as well. And just to give you another example of how it's used, there was a question about four-day work weeks. And they have been coming up periodically over time, and we've been asked, you know, do people have policies on four-day work weeks? And we were able to provide that information mm-hmm. immediately, and I think it's been really helpful for utilities.
So. So we will stop talking now because we want to hear from all of you, your thoughts, and anything that we can do to better assist you in the work that you do to serve your communities.
As we started off earlier, saying that we wanted to share with you, but more importantly, we wanted to hear from you. So this is the time that if you can provide us with any input, we talked about surveys. That's been one of the topics that's come up at meetings in the past where there's been requests for surveys, requests for information, basically just anything, and it doesn't have to be just today. This invitation to share with us is anytime. So not to put you on the spot, but want to thank you for allowing us to come today and allowing us to have an opportunity to present to you and also to let you know how much we appreciate you, your support. And when I mean support, I'm looking at Eric because Eric has given countless talks educationally on legal items. We just heard from Kelly last summer on finance items, and that was almost a standing ovation. It was so good. She did an excellent job. So the district has been very supportive of WAPUTA and providing resources along the way, and we're much appreciative of that support.
So, Gary, just a comment from another one of the has-beens that's in the room besides Dennis. You know, we put you in a tough spot because you're preaching to the choir. You know that. I'm just sitting here waiting to hear from our new manager, you know, just how he feels about the PUD Association. I mean, it's part of his first evaluation.
Commissioner Bowles did have his hand up, I think, too.
Dennis?
Yeah, just a couple of comments. Liz, nice job historically. around 1930 when the coalition came together to pass that PUD bill. It was one of the strangest political combinations in the history of the state because it was farmers and coming out of a Labor Day weekend and laborers that joined together to help create the PUD bill. And that doesn't happen very often. And then you were very correct in terms of what kind of separated the state of Washington, perhaps, from Oregon. It really went kind of through the same process at the same time. The investor-owned utilities wanted to club the public utilities that were just newly created, like rats. And it was in their best interest to drive us out of the business and reclaim the territory. And when the association formed and developed that coalition of being resistive of that attempt, all those battles took place in court. And it was really difficult for the investor-owned utilities to execute divide and conquer because the state didn't split. Lesson learned when they went to Oregon, which was a few years behind Washington, they attacked individually and split them. And that's why I think there's like six or seven public utility districts in Oregon and 28 in Washington. So the role of the association in its inception was incredibly important in terms of setting that precedence. And I think the last thing that I would like to say is I think one of the things that has really made us different, and this is my 16th year looking back, we have so many more women commissioners and general managers. It's just not quite the same good old boys club that it was. And that's a real nice step forward. So again, thank you for all you do. You know from my heart of hearts what I believe about this organization. And we're different in the state than anywhere else because of who we are and the leadership that has been exhibited and the current group of people who are in that office and working to meet the membership needs just makes us different. And you cannot step out of the borders of this state in the energy industry right now and find anything of its like this. So again, keep doing what you're doing. Do it with the vigor that you're doing and the intelligence that you have. Just such an appreciation for all of you.
I might add for our staff's recognition of what our association has done. Several of us in the state have been part for years and years of American public power policymaking. And over the years, we've become known as the Washington Mafia in a very affectionate way. And I look at the people sitting here and how they have helped to organize us and cultivate our knowledge base and understanding of the issues that surround the state. I think it's made us into what we are in terms of a force at the national level because of the association's assistance in what we're doing. So, Rachel, I saw your reaction to the mafia.
You know, and I think that is an important point because when we go back to D.C., and thank you, Commissioner Smith, for he always makes sure I don't get lost in the tunnels under the legislative buildings. But we're able to get into those offices because of our relationships with members of Congress, and those relationships start at the local level. So the fact that we're able to have those meetings and often meet with the members in person, I think, says a lot about our ability to cultivate our relationships locally, but then work cooperatively through the association to be able to share the message, not just from your local PUD, but from PUDs across the state when we get back to D.C.
And if I could just add one thing. And we talked a little bit, at least I think I talked a little bit about what we do, but a lot of the vast majority of what I do comes from your staff and other PUD staff. I mean, you guys are the information sources that we need on wildfire, on heat, on a myriad of other issues that allow us to be able to bring that information together and then to present it to the legislature or to policymakers and explain why it's important that they do X or Y or Z. But it really starts with your staff and your staff's expertise that we rely on day in, day out to be effective. So this is a big thank you to you guys for making them available to us so that we can learn and we can be then more effective on your behalf.
I might just share a perspective that I've shared with all the associations as I've gotten more involved in all the associations Chelan PUD belongs to, and that is that there's a unique opportunity right now and that is that there's a lot of workforce challenges, and everybody is experiencing them. And so one of the things that I've shared with all of our associations is, as each organization, whether it's around the state or whether it's around the region, is experiencing these challenges, that's where our associations can play a big role in, you know, looking for ways, if everybody's looking for a specialized skill set, if you will, we're all better off pooling our resources and supporting our associations and maybe providing that specialized skill set to benefit everybody rather than everybody trying to find their own and, you know, maybe 10% of those organizations finding that specialized skill set. So I think given that everybody is experiencing those challenges right now, I would encourage the PUD Association to look for those opportunities where everybody is struggling or trying to find a similar skill set but having trouble doing so. It might be better off for the association to provide that. I want to provide kudos, too, at the same time. Just you have found a way to, and I don't know that it's been this way forever, but you've been able to find a way to be very nimble. And that LNI heat rule, I think, is a really good example that you brought up about. I was really impressed with how fast that came up. And then you were able to get a sense of, hey, is this important to the association really quickly? And then be able to provide the feedback, the input, be a clearinghouse for that, and provide meaningful input into that process. And so I would just encourage you to things change fast now, and more so than they ever have. And so to the extent you can continue to provide ways to respond quickly, that's greatly appreciated.
Just one point on that. I mean, we found out about that particular issue literally 3 weeks ago, and it's outside of my strike zone, so to speak, of knowledge. And so that's where, you know, information from the utilities is really important. We were made aware of it by a utility, and once we became aware of it, we go, okay, well, is this a big deal or not? And then we started looking into it, and then we realized it was, and then we, you know, the process. And it was very rapid, and this process is probably going to take another 6 months before or longer before it comes to a conclusion. So we're far from done. But I'm just saying that when those issues, when you become aware of those issues, if you can let us know, then that's when we can be effective. It's hard to push back or to try to guide a rulemaking if you're not aware that.
The important piece of that process was we were able to get together subject matter experts from the PUDs very quickly. And that's where your contributions really help us. And so they were able to give feedback that was very well-informed feedback. And in the course of an hour, a little over an hour, we were able to come up with some really good communication points. So the next day when we went into that LNI meeting on the subject, Waputa had a very clear message, and I think it was very effective. The response we got is, oh, okay, we need to think about that. And that was thanks to this very cooperative effort on the staffing level. So that's a process that I think allows us to be nimble when our utilities are willing to step in and help.
Yeah, this is a good example of something that can't wait between for the next meeting, mm-hmm. if you will, a month away. This had to happen.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Kudos.
Well, if I were to give any specific ideas that I would throw out, one is an idea that I think would be very helpful. I think all of us together in PUDs and with our association need to help build cultures within our organizations. How do we do that? And I think one of the areas that I see us needing support is how to build that fearless culture. And we talked about it today earlier in our meeting. Amy Edmondson, a professor from Harvard, has studied this in research. How do we create an organization that, if we're going to become learners and rapidly learning, how do we fearlessly ask the questions and challenge and do create those cultures within our organizations that allow that to happen? And I think doing that on an organizational effort to bring somebody in that, like Amy or somebody like that, would be a big help. And then I think the other thing that struck me this weekend as I was driving back and forth is just the electrification of cars. I was just surprised this weekend. Maybe I just haven't been watching as I drive around, but as that becomes a bigger and bigger issue and challenge to us, how to take that challenge and look at it as an opportunity. Again, thinking differently, how do we do that as an organization? How do we do that statewide? What are things that we need to be thinking about? You know, how do we change that from challenge to opportunity? So those are my two thoughts, or whatever that's worth.
I'll chime in and say that Nicholas has a beautiful Tesla and has driven all over the state with that Tesla. And I have to tell you, at the first meeting, I was thinking to myself, well, he's not going to be able to get to Okanagan in one charge. But he did. And so I think a lot of that challenge at your
two charges.
And so I think a lot of the challenge that you're discussing is very accurate. And it's probably best spoken to by Nicholas, who has experienced it firsthand. And certainly going to put pressure on utilities going forward in the future.
Did he find our plug-in down below?
I did not, actually. I did not know you had one.
Does it do Tesla?
No. Well, it probably did my charger. It's not a Tesla supercharger. Yeah, I have one. Yeah.
So just two or three sentences on electric vehicles. From the association standpoint, one of the things we think about is grid reliability. We want to make sure that as we move forward, there is sufficient ability to actually service those cars with electricity. And one of the things we pointed out to the legislature and the regulatory agencies is that they are predicting that overall load is going to grow by 90% over the next 20 years. 90%. There's just not enough electricity out there to meet that load today. And it's not just 90%. It's 90% at the exact moment you need it. And so it doesn't matter if you have plenty in the middle of the summertime if you're a winter peaking utility or vice versa. So we have to figure out a way to be able to move power from where it is to where it needs to be, which leads to a discussion about transmission and then a discussion about distribution systems. And can your distribution systems handle the increased load? Are you going to have to put in new transformers? And then can you get to new transformers because of the supply chain issues? And do you have the workers that you are available to put them in? We're not saying all these things because we're antagonistic towards electric vehicles. In fact, I try to really articulate to the legislature and others listen that we really like selling. What we want to make sure is we can do so reliably and at a reasonable price and with clean electricity. Mm-hmm. And so trying to make sure that we are balanced is sort of our approach. But I agree with you. Your point is, how do you take this challenge that I just described and turn it into an opportunity? And, that's the challenge that we all face. And that's what we're trying to grapple with ourselves at the association. Obviously, we do it more from a sort of a psychological, mental level. You guys actually have to have the physical steel in the ground in order to do it. But, we try to think through what's the ways we can create laws and regulations and grants and other sorts of things that create opportunities and incentivize entities to take risks. Because right now there seems to be a lot more effort to put on sticks in place rather than carrots. And so part of the challenge that we have is trying to convince people that carrots are the appropriate motivational factor rather than stakes. So with that,
if there are no longer any comments, just know that one of the things which will be coming out of these meetings with the 28 PUDs is we've taken copious notes, right, Liz?
Yes.
Liz has done great. You really have. And so with all of these notes, we're going to compile them, put them together, and look for similarities, of which we expect there will be similarities, and make these available then at a future WAPUTA meeting so that all commissioners can be involved and all managers can be involved. And you'll see the fruits of what these meetings have brought forward for all of us as we all try to work together to create a stronger association and a stronger utility backbone in the state.
Thank you for being here today.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Steve, can we take just 5 minutes?
Yes. So let's go ahead and take a 5-minute break, and we'll be back after a short recess at 2 o'clock. Coming back out of our recess break and in our business session this afternoon. At this time, Kirk, I believe we still have a few items, manager items to review.
Yeah, we have one more. I'll ask Eric to give you all an update on our transformer purchases.
Yeah, thank you, commissioners. I'll try to be brief. I have to say thanks to Nicholas for the segue with the supply chain reference to the transformers. That was perfect. We did not prearrange that, though. We did want to provide you a short update and just a reminder, commissioners. We're still struggling with being able to obtain the necessary transformers we need to keep supporting the build out and the replacement. You might recall back on November 1st of 2021, the board passed an emergency resolution allowing staff to negotiate directly, waiving the bidding procedures and allowing staff to negotiate directly for the purchase of its distribution transformers. We actually did make a contract order on that about 15 days later. We were able to secure some pricing. Just as an illustrative comparison, by the way, the weeks of delivery for that order were 26. They've now increased to 76 weeks, and the pricing has nearly doubled on the transformers. So continuing to struggle as our others in the industry, we continue to cooperate with our sister and brother utilities, trying to support one another in the distribution transformer selection. But I did want to circle back and just let you know that we are planning to issue another order on that still open emergency resolution. This is one, it's a little over $1 million. It will take both, it'll be all the distribution transformers, pole mounted, pad mounted, and a couple of the larger sizes as well. Because of the delivery schedule, we're placing that order in this year, this calendar year, but those we don't anticipate receipt, obviously, until well into calendar year 2023, and we pay on delivery and receipt, so those dollars will appear in next year's budget, and that's when they'll be paid. But with the increasing delivery timelines, we really need to get our orders in. So because we're operating under the already approved emergency resolution, wanted to circle back with you all. It doesn't require or any action under the emergency resolution, but did want to touch point back to you and let you know that we're, I would say, experiencing even more significant challenges with the supply chain side as it relates to distribution transformers, for sure. But we're doing everything we can to get those orders in, and thank you for your emergency resolution and the support that provides. I know that staff is looking forward to that. Appreciate it.
Thank you for sharing that with us.
Those are all the manager items.
Pardon?
Those are all the manager items.
Thank you. All right. Lisa Sanders, commission travel.
Yes. I'm here. Don't have a lot coming up. We do have Commissioner Arsenault to Spokane tomorrow. He is a keynote speaker on the 9th at the Utilities Technology Council. the September WAPUTA meetings. Everyone is registered. Commissioner Arsenault, I've changed your hotel to Town Place.
Thank you.
I have canceled Commissioner McKenna's. Then I have Commissioners Bowles and Congdon attending virtually.
You skipped me.
I did?
That's because I didn't change any.
Oh.
That's right.
Yes.
Okay, I'm
yes,
still on.
Commissioner Smith is attending as well. Right. Staying at the DoubleTree. In case anyone wants to visit him there. September 21 through 23, we have the water workshop. I need to check with Commissioner Congdon to see if you still have plans to attend that or we need to make adjustments.
Lisa, this is Ann. I probably am not going to be able to, based on where I'm at right now. So,
do you want me to see if there's a virtual
option? Yeah, please. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. And if you need to have me talk to them about why I'm canceling, I can share that. I'd be happy to share that with them.
Oh, I'm sure we're fine. It's early enough, I think. We'll be okay with that.
Okay, thank you.
In October, we have Commissioner Arsenault attending the Budget Committee meeting. Is that virtual?
That's virtual.
Oh, yeah, it says virtual right there. So we have October WAPUTA roundtables. I don't have a date, though.
Don't know that we have any in October. We don't normally have roundtables, do we, Liz?
I think these are the professional group roundtables. So they're going to send out a list of different roundtables.
If
you want those exact dates,
I can. Oh, I can. I'll look it up. Yeah. So I'll take this. I'll remove this from your schedule. We have later in October, Commissioner McKenna attending Energy Northwest. And then November WAPUTA meetings. Need to know who wants to attend in person and virtually and confirm with Commissioner Arsenault. Do you want to change your hotel from the Olympia Hotel at Capitol Lake to Town Place again?
Let's leave it there for now.
Leave it?
Yeah.
Okay. Would everyone else like to be registered?
November?
Yes.
Yes, please.
Yes. Okay.
Lisa, do you have the date on that Energy Northwest meeting?
I have October 27th.
Thank you.
Do you know if there's a member forum that they used to have one before COVID? Energy Northwest had a member forum that same time in conjunction with your meeting.
I don't know that.
Yeah, Randy's right. They always did have a forum in the during the October session. And it's usually well done.
Yeah, usually a day and a half.
Are you?
I'd be interested in that if there is one.
Okay. I can check on that. Shall we keep going into November? Later in November, we have the WAPUTA annual conference.
That's first week of December.
I'm November 30 to December 2nd.
Do we have a location for that yet?
We might, but I don't know what it is.
Okay, but I'll be going.
Okay.
That's in Spokane.
Thank you.
November. I don't think I'll be going to that.
Okay. Let me know if your plans change.
I think my daughter getting married that weekend probably will impact that. So
that's important.
All right. I think
Anything else? Any changes, corrections?
Sounds good. Thank you, Lisa.
Okay. Thanks.
Thanks, Lisa.
Okay, commission items. Commissioners, we have a couple of special meetings that we need to make motions on. Anybody interested in doing that, please?
Sure. I'd like to move to set following special meetings on Tuesday, September 22nd, 2022 at 1 p.m. at Confluence Technology Center, 285 Technology Center Way, Wenatchee, for the purpose of holding tri-commission meeting, and Wednesday, October 12, 2022, at 1 p.m. at the Confluence Technology Center, 285 Technology Center Way, Wenatchee, for the purpose of holding a board workshop.
Do I have a second?
Second.
All those in favor of those two meetings signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes. Do we have any other commissioner items?
I suppose I'd like to just call something to attention. And this has to do with what Nicholas was saying earlier during the Waputo conversation. You may be aware of the fact that California is experiencing some pretty high temperatures right now. And as a result of that, there's an added burden put on their electrical grid system. Compounding that problem is a large and still growing electric vehicle implementation in the state of California. So Governor Newsom has requested that individuals who do own electric vehicles in the state of California refrain from charging those vehicles except during certain parts of the evening when there are surplus capacity available for electric charging. I think this speaks to the question that the topic that Nicholas brought up earlier, and that is the demand for electric vehicles is growing exponentially, and yet the infrastructure system can be taxed in order to charge those vehicles. So it's something that we as a utility and certainly in the Pacific Northwest need to be paying attention to. Of course, the media is somewhat having a heyday with the implementation of and the push for electric vehicles, and at the same time telling people you can't charge them. So and most recently, the governor also implemented a ban on combustion engines at some date in the future. So all of this is coming to a head, and I think that we need to certainly be paying attention to the implications it has for our utility and our county as we go forward.
Commissioners, anything else? Okay, hearing none. Follow up on delegation action items from previous board meetings.
We just had one, and that was that Rebecca will coordinate tours for Commissioners Congdon and Arsenault. We'll remove this from the action item list as she coordinates those tours out at the hydros in a structured visit. And then no new action items from today.
All right. Do we have any additional public comment for today's meeting? All right. Are there any other matters of general business as may necessarily come before the commission today? Hearing none, we are adjourned to executive session, recess to executive session to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board is likely to become a party and or legal risk as authorized by RCW 42.30.110, and that will be for how long?
90 minutes.
90 minutes. We are recessed. We are coming out of executive session. No decisions were made. No votes were taken. Is there any additional business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we stand adjourned.